Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. I feel alright, I feel alright tonight.
All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here at WGN. We are 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. That means one artist, three songs. Get your requests in now. We'll play them later. It's 312-981-7200. You pick the music bumps every morning on the show. We have a theme each day, and today is Triple Play Thursday. So 312-981-7200 right here on WGN. Hey, coming up in just a few minutes, our good friend Dan Feinberg is going to join us for his biweekly visit. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Lots of TV to talk about, and the upfront press conferences where the networks talk about what's coming up for the fall and for the new season, and talk about basically the state of the union of the networks. That'll be coming up. It's a big deal, and Dan always covers it, and we'll talk about that and new shows and old shows and all kinds of cool stuff. TV talk in general with Dan Feinberg coming up in just a few minutes. Is the anniversary of the death of Bonnie and Clyde. So we're going to talk about some facts about the outlaw duo and talk a little bit about that. And then talk a little bit about the movie that was made back in the day in the 60s. One of the best movies of the 60s, actually. Get into that. And then they were kind of gunfighters. So we're going to talk about the best gunfighters in TV and movie history. Most of these are Westerns, but there's some modern ones on here, too. We're going to talk about the best gunfighters in TV and movie history, because, you know, there were lots of guns involved when it came to Bonnie and Clyde. So and then we're going to talk about real life crimes that were kind of crazy. So a little crime themed Thursday morning for you. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Talk and text anytime you want, and also for your Triple Play Thursday requests. You can follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is to connect with us on our Facebook page. Like us right now at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Lots of interactive stuff happening. Whatever's happening on the show is updated on our Facebook page live. So always follow us on Facebook and like us right now, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And subscribe to our podcast. It's free. It's a great way to listen to the show. We have a lot of people who listen to our podcast, and we really appreciate that. That's really nice of you guys. And I know some people can't stay up between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. every morning, so the best way to do it is to subscribe and get our podcast. You can go to iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Nick D Show. It's absolutely free, and it'll automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So that's what's coming up on the show. Again, 312-981-7200 is the way to stay connected to us and get your Triple Play Thursday requests in. Let me say hello to my producer, Tom Hush. Tom, how are you?
Doing good, Nick. How are you?
I'm all right. Incredible Cub game again.
Yeah.
Three bombs that made up the offense for the game.
I think it was the one I got to see was Rizzo, right?
Did you see Rizzo like pull a natural and bust out a light on the on Budweiser sign?
It was amazing.
He pulled a natural. He did a Robert Redford.
Woo!
And that was a bomb.
He caught all of it.
Oh my God! He crushed it. And I feel a little nostalgic and a little sad because, you know, you remember those days? Well, no, you don't, because you're too young. But there used to be a bunch of kids, sometimes adults, with their mitts out on Waveland, and out on Sheffield, waiting for the balls to fly out on the street and catch them. They're not really out there anymore because they got those damn video signs up And that, because that would have been, that would have hit a building on the other side of the street.
Oh,
on Sheffield.
Absolutely.
That was a bomb.
Yeah, when
that,
I was a kid, people still did that.
Yeah.
In the like late 90s.
That was
still
that's
happening.
True, because they didn't build those those video screens. And I don't want to sound like an old man, like, I prefer Wrigley Field when it was. But when I was a kid, that was cool, man. You just
There would be huge crowds out there.
Exactly. Hanging out by the firehouse with their gloves and all that stuff. And now they got those two big video screens out there. And, you know, man. But anyway, and then El Morro Jr.'s first ever professional Grand Slam, which was great. And then, of course, Javi hit a bomb because he's Javi.
The Javi bomb.
Yeah, they came back from a 3-0 deficit, won that game 8-3. So, great game for the Cubs. Vic is in the newsroom. Vic Vaughn, hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great.
Hey, you're covering the... am I right? Did the White Sox pull a triple play tonight, last night?
I don't have the details on that. I just have the, you know, the scores and
I'm going to have to look that up. I think the White Sox pulled off. I mean, we had the game on here at GN because we broadcast it.
We're
the broadcast station of the Chicago White Sox, and they played the game last night and they won. They won big. But I think I heard that they had a triple play. So if we can find out about that, maybe
Eloy Jimenez homers twice. Charlie Tilson hit grand slam. Yeah.
No triple play.
Oh. No.
No triple play.
I'm getting this from Tribune now. I'm not a sports reporter, but Eloy Jimenez homered twice. Charlie Tilson hit a grand slam. White Sox turned a triple play and 9-4 win
there
over
you
the
go.
Astros.
Yeah. That's what I thought. Triple
Beautiful.
Play. Triple play. Always a fun thing. Always. Yeah. So, Vic, how you doing, buddy?
Good. Yeah.
I understand that you were listening to a little Ray Charles.
Oh, man. I'm going to be listening to him for a while.
Yeah.
That's 9 hours of...
Well, tomorrow we will begin our weekly check-in with Vic, because Vic is educating himself on music, going through the Rolling Stone top 100 albums of all time, of which he's not familiar with. Like, he didn't know who he had never heard of Sympathy for the Devil. Let's just say that ever. And so he's learning about music.
There's a lot of songs that I had not.
So, but we're gonna check in with Vic tomorrow at some point, and it's gonna be a new Friday segment where every week we're gonna check in with Vic as he educates himself with music with Vic's Picks.
It is so fun.
Yeah. All right, listen, we got a break. Dan Feinberg is going to join us. You guys stick around. TV Talk right after this on 720 WGN.
TV Party tonight! We're going to have a TV party tonight! All right! We're going to have a TV party, all right! Tonight! Saturday Night Live! Monday Night Football! Jefferson!
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. And it's Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. And that's one artist, three songs. And you can call it 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for it. That's one artist, three songs, Triple Play Thursday. And there you go. We are here. It's a Thursday morning, and we're going to be talking about Bonnie and Clyde. It's the anniversary of their death, and we're also going to talk about great gunfighters in movie history and TV history as well, and more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text, and there you go. Now, it is time for us to say hello to our good friend Dan Feinberg, a TV critic for Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Lots of stuff to talk about this week. And there's always lots of TV, but we have a lot of stuff to talk about with Dan because of the upfront press conferences that happened this past week. Or let's bring Dan to the show. Hey, Dan.
How are you doing, Nick?
Good. How are you, sir?
Oh, busy.
Yeah.
Busy.
All right. Well, let's get to the upfront press conferences in a little bit, okay? We'll save on that a little bit. Before we jump in, it's on my DVR, and I'm going to watch it in the morning. Did you watch that live All in the Family Jeffersons thing last night?
I did indeed.
And should I look forward to it?
Some. It's a fun thing, and I would love for them to keep doing it. I think that a lot of the performances are perhaps a little bit too kind of indebted to the original actors because you just can't get away from them.
Sure.
And I would say that Woody Harrelson was probably a particular disappointment just because Archie Bunker is so indelible, and unfortunately he's kind of doing an impression. But in general, it goes to show, A, how sharp those scripts were, and it's a lot of actors having a lot of fun. It's definitely worth watching.
Good.
It's just not consistent, but... You know, why would anyone have expected it to be consistent?
Right. I loved the idea. When I first heard about it, when Kimmel first plugged it, like about a month ago or so, I was like, wow, that's really great. And then just like having the star power that they have and the celebrities that were involved, I thought it would be a lot of fun.
It definitely is, and I hope that people watch it because it seems like the kind of thing where if you could turn it into an annual tradition or... You know, even more than that, it would be a really good way to educate some young viewers on television history.
Yeah.
and kind of the shifts in the format. So I hope people tuned in. I'm curious as to how a lot of the humor and jokes played for very young viewers, but I also don't know how many very young viewers were probably watching it tonight.
I'm looking forward to it. I agree with you 100%. I think they should do that some more. Turn some people on to stuff that they maybe don't know about, a younger generation that they don't know about, especially with stars that they like now, which I think is an interesting way to do it.
It's a minor frustration, though, because even if it turns out that audiences watch this and really like it, the shows aren't available in streaming anywhere, so it's kind of introducing them to something that they can't then go and immediately watch on Hulu, Netflix, Amazon, whatever their streaming platform of choice is. So
yeah.
It's a little bit of a tease if it turns out the viewers actually really love it.
Yeah.
So yeah, but still, I hope they do it more in the future. It seems like the kind of thing that you could have a lot of fun with as an annual event.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, I'm looking forward to watching that. And I have to watch, of course, What We Do in the Shadows. I will watch that right after I watch Y'all in the Family. I thought last week's What We Do in the Shadows was again, hilarious. But the one with all the cameos that you told me about was unbelievable.
the cameos in that one were pretty spectacular,
yeah.
And it kind of kept going because all that FX did when they sent out the screeners to press was they just said, don't spoil the cameo. So it's like, okay, fine, whatever. And like the first one or two people show up and you're like, okay, sure. Dave Bautista could be the cameo they
right.
didn't want me spoiling.
Right.
He's pretty big. You
yeah.
know, he's in the Avengers and all that. And then it goes one after another,
oh,
after another, after another. Pretty crazy.
It was pretty crazy. And Kristen Schaal, too, could have been
totally.
A cameo as well. And she was hilarious in that episode. Hilarious.
It is exactly the kind of world in which Kristen Schaal fits right in, to be sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like the training of I always forget her name, Jonah Hill's sister.
I also do, and I need to see her movie this weekend so that I can remember who she is.
I hear it's fantastic. I hear it's great. I'm seeing it this weekend as well. And she was great in Lady Bird, and she's really funny on What We Do in the Shadows. And how she's handling the training, the Nadja character is handling the training. I love it when she refers to her as a stupid little vampire baby, which just cracked me up every time she said it. So.
I thought the digital effects on her version of the bat were rather ridiculously hilarious.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of FX, man, I thought Fosse Verdon, the episode from Tuesday night of Fosse Verdon, that's the one that they have to send in for Michelle Williams to get the Emmy. That's got to be the one, right?
I would guess probably. I mean, she's had a few really good episodes, like, say, four or five in a row. It's not like they can choose a wrong one. This one had a lot of musical stuff, so, you know, if they want to accentuate that, there she did pretty much sing halfway through Chicago, so yay. And then she also did the Lupita Nyong'o voice from Us for about 5 minutes. That was a little strange.
That didn't even occur to me. But yeah. That...
I thought of it immediately, and I'm like, okay, there's no way that this was not shot beforehand. So she definitely did not do it intentionally.
Right.
But goodness gracious, she was doing the Lupita Nyong'o voice.
You're absolutely right. I can't believe that didn't even enter my mind while I was watching it. But yeah, you're right. You're right.
It might have ruined it for you. So better that it didn't. But no, I liked a lot of this episode, and I thought it played Fosse's insecurities on a different level than, say, the past three or four have. So I just get fatigued when they do the montage of him popping pills and screwing different women and stuff. I'm like, I've seen that before, but there were a lot of things he did in this past episode that were, I would say, borderline sociopathic.
Oh yeah.
And And yet were fascinating to watch in a different way from just the, oh, look, he's cheating on his wife and doing drugs. So yeah. I appreciated the different colors he got to play.
Yeah, the week before, the episode before was just like, it was all that jazz light, essentially. And I was, that was, to me, that's the weakest episode of the entire season. And I love the fact that this one was told from her point of view specifically. And that scene where they're performing the number for her, and he's just sitting there, they're in the theater lobby, and he wants to make it a duet instead of a solo. That whole scene to me, like from beginning to end, especially when Michelle Williams just goes off, I just thought that was one of the best acted scenes in the series. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, that was a great scene, and it was a great scene for Michelle Williams. That category at the Emmys is going to be insane with the competition between Michelle Williams, Amy Adams, and Patricia Arquette. That is a good race to watch. If the Emmys knew what was good for them, they'd hold that one for right near the very end.
Yeah, no question. All right, finales have happened. A couple of big finales. Let's go to Big Bang Theory. I never watched the show because I just never thought it was funny. But how did the Big Bang Theory finale go for you? Because I think it was satisfying for a lot of fans, right?
I thought it was, and it had an easier job to be satisfying than the other finale that I assume that we will talk about next, just because the Game of Thrones finale had clear expectations, people had needs that had to be met, blah, 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 and the Big Bang Theory did not have that. It really just had to end on the right emotional note, whatever it happened to be, and they had to choose what the note was, and I thought they landed it emotionally fairly well, and they did a very good job of making sure that the actors who needed emotional screen time did well with that. So I thought that it was a great episode for Jim Parsons, it was a great episode for Johnny Galecki, it was a great episode for Kaley Cuoco, and the plot took the characters to a nice enough resting place, I guess, but all I wanted to do was to laugh a couple times and to feel a little bit of emotion at the end as it ended, and I thought that they did that well.
Okay. All right, and before we break here, we don't have to spend a ton of time on it because everybody's been talking about it. What did you think of the Game of Thrones?
I thought it had good moments, and I thought it had frustrating moments. There are things about it that are still kind of sticking in my craw, scenes that don't make any sense to me at all. But it was such an exhausting season, and the audience reactions for the entire season were so exhausting that I feel like we all probably just need like 6 months, a year, 5 years to sort of cool down, and then we can all come back together and go, okay, so what did you really think of the Game of Thrones finale? Because we're too close to it now.
Right. Okay. All right. I love the fact that then the water bottle thing happened, and this is like 2 weeks after the coffee cup thing. I just
very, very strange that like the script supervisor got laid off early on in production or something. I don't know how to explain any of it.
So crazy. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. We're going to talk about some new TV, and the upfront press conferences happened. A busy time for Dan Feinberg. It's always great when he joins us every 2 weeks. He writes for the Hollywood Reporter, and you can check him out on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. More TV talk after the news right here on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories of a beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. So this is the anniversary of Bonnie and Clyde's death, and we're going to talk about some facts about that outlaw duo, talk about Bonnie and Clyde the movie and how they've been portrayed, and then the 25 best gunfighters in TV and movie history. We're also going to talk about real-life crimes, kind of a crime related theme this morning on the show. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Nick D Show, and you can also give us a call, text, and Triple Play Thursday request at 312-981-7200. We are joined every 2 weeks with by Dan Feinberg, who TV critic for the Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. Lots of TV to talk about. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. So let's talk about now. We've been waiting years for this. May 31st on HBO. It's finally good. It's going to be a big day for me because not only does the Deadwood movie premiere on HBO, but Godzilla opens on that day. So that's like a bookend of love for me. But I'm very curious, and I know we've been waiting a long time. You saw the Deadwood movie. What did you think?
I thought that it was satisfying and did what fans needed it to do. I think that's the way that I'm putting it, is I don't know that it's an urgent story that David Milch wrote for this. And everyone who watched Deadwood knows that the third season ended very much not as a finale. It was not designed as a finale. It did not feel like a finale. Lots of times you get normal season finales that feel like they could substitute in as series finales. This didn't even feel like that. Going back and rewatching it now, it is, it just leaves you.
Yeah.
And so fans have had to sit around with that for 13 years. And knowing that that was not the way anything was supposed to end. And knowing that HBO has always been so great at making sure that things got to end on their own terms, even if those terms infuriated some people. And that's ultimately what this does. It sets things right internally. If you've been kind of twisted up inside, if you've been holding your breath on the Deadwood world, the movie is 110 minutes of bringing you to where you need to get to walk away contentedly. And I think there's a lot of value in that. The story of it is pretty straightforward. It's enough to bring the characters back together. There's a murder that gets everyone tense in Deadwood, and everyone stares at each other and grits their teeth and swears at each other and in all the ways that you want them to. And all of the actors are wonderful, and time has aged all of them, even if a lot of that was done in a makeup chair, because in a lot of these people's cases, they barely aged at all. But it's satisfying. It didn't blow me away. I think if you're keeping in mind at all times kind of the backstory and David Milch's diagnosis of Alzheimer's recently and how that's been in the news, that adds a lot of weight to it. And there's a lot of it that's about memory and about time passing people by. And if you're sitting watching and you're thinking, okay, you know, I know what this means to David Milch.
Yeah, absolutely.
It does hit you in a different way, but it's satisfying, and that to me is so important. It does nothing to ruin the show. It does nothing to ruin the characters, and that's always my biggest concern when we go back to these worlds: is will it feel the same, and will I feel as if they're pandering to me, and did they ruin my memories of a perfectly good thing? Yeah. This does not do that.
Good. I'm really looking forward to it. I can't wait. I'm curious, do they handle the Powers Booth thing okay?
Very, very little, honestly. It's acknowledged, it's touched on. Joni has a major role, and so she kind of acknowledges it, but it's not like anyone stops and pauses and, you know, celebrates the life of Cy Tolliver, because that would be a strange thing. I think I might have expected a beat or two more of emotion around that particular boss, but that just doesn't seem to have been the way that Milch wanted to approach it.
Okay. All right. Well, that premieres on Friday, May 31st on HBO. So really, really looking forward to that. So my friend and future ex-wife, Dana DiLorenzo from Ash vs. Evil Dead, is part of a new show from Steve Conrad called Perpetual Grace Limited. Have you seen it yet?
I have not seen that one, and my colleague Tim Goodman, who is one of the world's biggest fans of Steve Conrad's Amazon series
Patriot.
Which is perpetually on my I need to catch up on
list. Yeah, absolutely.
And the thing is, it seems like exactly the kind of show that I would like and that I would really enjoy. And I watched the pilot back when it was part of an Amazon pilot season, back when they used to do that. And it just, for whatever reason, didn't hit me right at that moment. And then it was as simple as Tim reviewing it and loving it going forward. And so then I felt two seasons behind, and that show is in kind of limbo. And but yes, I'm definitely curious what this one is going to look like, but I haven't rushed to watch it because it's a Tim Goodman review.
Yeah, I gotcha. Okay, well, I'm looking forward to it because I'm real good friends with Dana DiLorenzo at this point, and she was posting pictures last night. They had the premiere, and she was posting pictures. Evidently, she doesn't work with Ben Kingsley. And she doesn't have any scenes with Ben Kingsley, and met him last night at the premiere. And there's she posted a picture on Twitter of her embarrassing herself because she tends to talk a lot. And there's a picture of her just gushing about Ben Kingsley, and she's got her hands in her face like she's embarrassed, and Ben Kingsley's got his hand on her shoulder like it's okay, it's all right. So, but she's very excited.
I should be intimidates a lot of people.
Absolutely. Immediately if I were going to see him, I'd think Sexy Beast and then run. But she's very happy with it, very proud of it. And she gets most of her scenes with Louis Guzman. She plays his mistress. So, which I think
it has an amazing cast of character actors.
It does,
and so I'm very curious to see how it plays. Also curious to see how many people can figure out if they have FX, because I don't have it. So
this is the second time I've subscribed to a channel because of Dana. Because I didn't have Stars until Ash versus, well, that's not because of Dana. I met Dana after Ash versus Evil Dead started. But that's, I got Stars because of that. And I now have Epics because I want to watch Perpetual Grace. So that premieres next Sunday. So
it's a good thing she's not more prolific though, cause that would really start hurting your bottom line at a certain point if she signed up for too many shows on too many channels.
Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about When They See Us. This is on Netflix, and you saw that one and popped a review on The Hollywood Reporter. Tell us about that.
Indeed. That is also premiering next Friday. So next Friday is a big day between that and the Deadwood movie. It's not really all that surprising that it's a big day, because that is also the last day of the pre-Emmy window for next year's Emmys.
Okay, so that makes sense.
There are a couple things that are sneaking in under the wire, and these two are big ones. When They See Us is Ava DuVernay's four-part, but several of the parts are really long. A couple of the parts are basically 90 minutes, so it's not 4 hours. It's more like 5 hours and 10, 520. And it is her take on the Central Park 5 story that goes out of its way to only barely ever use the phrase Central Park 5. It's sort of the principle of it is that the name Central Park 5 was the name that the New York tabloid media, that the New York police, that Donald Trump, that a bunch of people trying to railroad these five young men assigned to them basically as a way of taking away their humanity.
Right.
And the miniseries is to some degree about restoring their names, restoring their humanity, and it's extremely powerful. It's very, very well acted. It has some structural things that I'm not sure I fully get, kind of decisions in how the story is told, gaps in the narrative and whatnot, but it's impressive. It hits you in the gut an awful lot. It fills you with exactly the sense of outrage that, you know, it's designed to do.
Yeah.
And I think it's fairly impressive. And it's another thing that will be in the movie miniseries, limited series Emmy field, though it does not have a lead female performance to compete with all of the other great people we talked about earlier.
Got it. Okay. And it's got a hell of a cast. I'm looking at this cast. Man, oh, man. I mean, Omar's in it. Michael K. Williams. Vera Farmiga, John Leguizamo, Felicity Huffman. I wonder how people are going to take that.
She's playing the prosecuting attorney who railroaded and constructed the case around these five young men. So it is very much a heel turn, and probably the fact that we're already looking at her out of the side of our eyes,
yeah,
it probably benefits.
There's a lot of great names in this. I'm looking at this, and anything with William Sadler, and I'm in. That's how it works with me. I love that guy.
But the thing of note is that most of these people are in it for, I don't want to say blink and you miss them,
right,
but I would say with William Sadler, it's pretty close to that. He's got a couple scenes in the first episode and a couple scenes in the fourth episode, and that's basically okay. it. There's one episode that focuses on the actual court case and the attorneys for the Central Park Five, for the young men. They're played by Joshua Jackson, Christopher Jackson from Hamilton, and also, I guess, from Bull, if that matters, and Blair Underwood. And so you've got those very yeah. big actors. They're only in one episode. Felicity Huffman is in two episodes. It's a lot of actors kind of coming in to enrich very, very small parts with the fact that they're awesome. And
I got it.
It's a great strategy if you're Ava DuVernay and you can get John Leguizamo to come in for a week or two. You can get Michael Kenneth Williams to come in for a week or two, and suddenly those little parts become fantastic.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. That's When They See Us, which is debuting on Netflix on the May 31st. So we're going to take a break. We come back, more TV talk with Dan Feinberg on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here in Chicago, downtown Chicago. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. Got a crime theme for the rest of the show. Real crimes. We're talking about Bonnie and Clyde, and then gunslingers on TV and in movies. 312-981-7200, which also ties into Deadwood, which we were talking about a little bit earlier with our guest, Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, and that's F-I-E-N. Lots more TV to talk about. Let's welcome Dan back to the show. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, and Seth Bullock definitely should be one of the top gunslingers, and of course, Raylan Givens as well. So Timothy Oliphant, he slings guns well.
He does. He absolutely does, no question about it. All right, let's jump into the upfront press conferences here. Tell everybody what that is.
So basically, the upfronts are the 4 days in May where the television networks, the broadcast television networks, present their new schedules to advertisers. It's to some degree a relic of the old television industry where the broadcast networks were either A, the only show in town, or B, the most significant show in town. They are not that anymore. And so the upfronts week, when I started covering TV, and I'm not saying that was back in the golden ages, we're not talking back in the All in the Family time, but, you know, we're talking 15 years ago, it really was the biggest week of work in the entire calendar, because basically the upfronts, the process of covering them consists of there's a press release with the new schedules, and there's a press conference with a network executive, usually done by the phone, and then there's a long, between an hour and 2 hours, dog and pony show for the advertisers at different New York City venues. But in the week leading up to it, it's nonstop, one after another, cancellation, renewal. It'd be, you know, just days where if you cover the industry, you're in front of your computer at 7 a.m. and you can't go to lunch without something being canceled or renewed. And it's just exhausting and wearing. It's not really that anymore because no one cares as much. Also, people are canceling fewer things. So there were probably only about two-thirds the cancellations this year as last year, possibly even less than that, because a lot of things with low ratings kind of in this economy scrape by for two seasons, three seasons, just because that's how the business runs. So it feels different now than it did even 5 or 10 years ago.
Well, what were some of the notable cancellations?
There really were very, very few. To me, the biggest, most notable cancellation was ABC's Speechless, which is a show that I adore. I think it is a great show. I think it is a special show that serves a specific purpose in the TV landscape, both in terms of being a very, very funny family comedy, but also a family comedy about a family with a disabled child and how they come together and, you know, just them being a family, which is not represented on television all that frequently. And unfortunately, it was canceled because the ratings were not very good, of course, but ABC probably could have kept it around for another year or two if they wanted to, and it could still hypothetically get saved. That's the other silly thing about the upfronts these days, is that anything that gets canceled one day, say, for example, Fox canceling Brooklyn Nine-Nine last year, can
right.
get hypothetically picked up by NBC literally the next day. Nothing like that happened this year, but it could still happen. But, yeah there were no huge or shocking cancellations, really and truly. And so, minor disappointment there. Yeah, you like the drama of it.
Fine, right. Okay, well, let's go. CBS, what did you think of their presentation?
I think that CBS's presentation every year tends to be the more people watch CBS than anything else. And so CBS doesn't usually need to bring all that much drama. This year, the press conference before the actual presentation had a little bit of drama because there were people asking why CBS decided to renew Bull, which had a lot of bad press last year involving a large settlement that they cut with Eliza Dushku about complaints about the working conditions on the show and harassment. And, you know, CBS paid her off and it was unpleasant. And CBS decided to pick the show up anyway. And they say that they picked it up because they feel as if it was a one-time behavior from Michael Weatherly, who has made CBS an awful lot of money over the years thanks to NCIS. So that was who they decided to give the benefit of the doubt to.
And speaking of which, of a very similar situation, how did they handle the Les Moonves thing?
They acknowledged it at the press conference, you know, in the they asked, you know, reporters asked them, did it feel different making your schedule this year without Les Moonves?
Yeah.
And they said on the press conference, yes, it felt different. And then at the actual presentation itself, Stephen Colbert made one joke about it early in his, basically each one of the networks brings out their principal comic voice to make fun of the entire process. It's the thing that Jimmy Kimmel does better than anyone. He is spectacular and so far and away the best of the best at it. Colbert is okay, and he did make a Les Moonves joke, and it was the only one, and the audience kind of made uncomfortable sounds, and Colbert said, well, you knew there had to be one. There was literally only one, though.
Mm-hmm.
NBC had Seth Meyers, who was actually not very good. I usually think he's very good, but for whatever reason, they didn't want him making too many jokes about NBC, and so he didn't, and it wasn't funny. But as ever, Kimmel was extraordinarily funny, and he really is the king at that particular piece of entertainment.
Yeah. So what do CBS's shows look like?
CBS's shows look, I would say, interesting. They have a Chuck Lorre multicam with the somewhat cumbersome name of Bob Hart's Abishola. So,
what?
You know, that's not a name that, it stars Billy Gardell from Mike and Molly as a large man who appears to be in the sock business. again, I've only seen the trailer for this. In the
right.
trailer, he talks a lot about socks. So I'm assuming it's professional. Otherwise, he's just a foot fetishist, which is also perfectly valid for a TV show. So anyway, he has a heart attack or something, and he has an African nurse whose name is Abishola, who takes care of him and changes his life. And the trailer has a sort of the mix of broad laughs and sincerity kind of thing that Chuck Lorre does very, very well on Mom. So it could be good. They've got something called Evil, which is from the Kings, the couple behind Good Fight and Good Wife, and they're very talented. And Evil has a very commercial feel. It appears to be part legal drama, part supernatural thriller, and part kind of dark comedy, it looks like. It's got a really good cast. Mike Coulter from Luke Cage and Good Wife. Michael Emerson from Lost and People of Interest. Katya Herbers, who people may or may not know from Manhattan and from a couple episodes of Westworld. So it's got a good cast. It looks like it could be good. They've also got, of all things, a single camera comedy starring Walton Goggins from The Shield and Justified as a really nice widower. So
that's weird.
it is odd casting. But as I keep saying, look, he has been so good at playing these off-kilter, vaguely evil, vaguely crazy characters, and doing it on cable. If someone wants to give Walton Goggins the chance to play a nice guy for a little while and to make some CBS sitcom money, I am not going to be.
Oh yeah, no, I agree with you. I love that guy. I want him to work as much as humanly possible. So
I do. I still regret he had last development season an LA Confidential adaptation that CBS was briefly high on it that didn't go forward, and he was playing Jack Vincennes. He was playing the Kevin Spacey role from the movie, and that to me seemed like such a good idea, and I really wanted that to go forward so much, and for whatever reason, it was not CBS enough, so.
All right.
Oh, well.
Okay, and that's, by the way, that show is called The Unicorn.
Yes, right. That is the strange name of that show is The Unicorn, because when I say a show called The Unicorn, you think Walton Goggins is a lovable widower.
All right, Dan, hang out, okay?
Sure.
All right, we got to take a break here for the news, and when we come back, more from the upfront press conferences. We'll get more details about what's happening on the other networks as well. And that's Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN. We'll be back after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We are here until 5 a.m. Thursday, Triple Play Thursday, one artist, three songs. Get your requests in now, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about Bonnie and Clyde. We're going to talk about famous gunslingers in TV and in movies. And real crimes coming up on the show. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Triple Play Thursday requests. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Nick D Show. Like us right now. Dan Feinberg joins us every couple of weeks. TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. More TV to talk about with Dan. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right. Well, let's talk about the upfront for ABC.
Well, ABC had, basically, ABC was kind of folded in towards the end of a massive two-plus-hour presentation by the entire newly formed Walt Disney Television Group that now includes a lot of Fox things. So that presentation included an appearance by John Landgraf from FX, who briefly talked about the new season of Fargo, which will be out sometime next year,
yes.
Hopefully, but
yes.
There was footage of Chris Rock talking about it, so that looked exciting. I mean, I can't think there was anything that anyone mentioned all up front's week that I'm looking forward to more than another season of Fargo.
Right,
so,
I can understand that.
By all means. Also featured National Geographic talking about the next season of Genius, which will be Aretha Franklin, so that might be fine. And then by the time ABC got around to actually doing its upfront, there was really very little for ABC to talk about. And also, ABC picked up only five or six new shows. So ABC has, among other things, they have something called Stumptown, which is based on a comic series and stars Kobe Smulders from How I Met Your Mother as a gumshoe detective of some sort in Portland. It looked okay, I guess. I'm not getting excited about it, but I'm also not annoyed by it. They made the sad thing about not picking up Speechless, and that was too bad, but they picked up a Blackish spinoff about Young Rainbow. That's the Tracy Ellis Ross character.
Right.
That looks like it could be okay. They picked up a sort of supernaturally looking procedural starring Alison Tolman from the aforementioned Fargo. She is always good. But this was not the most exciting looking slate of new broadcast shows ever, and ABC was not hugely exciting, but the major purpose of that upfront was that ABC is part of this massive family now at Walt Disney, Fox, television entertainment group, and they're just going to buy and sell all of us.
and you said Jimmy Kimmel was incredibly entertaining.
Yes, Jimmy Kimmel was very funny. Definitely, Jimmy Kimmel was the highlight. He made definite jokes about the futility of doing this on an annual basis, and made jokes about all of the things that people were excited about last year that didn't go anywhere. And the fact that advertisers come out every year and basically throw their money down a well, and that is true. That is what this week is. That was what last week is all about. Is people throwing money down a well.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to NBC and Fox.
NBC has a couple interesting looking things. NBC's basic point was we're pretty stable, and that's not all that exciting. But they announced a lot of things that look very familiar and reassuring. So there's a legal drama set in Memphis starring Jimmy Smith. Okay, sure. You can probably guess what that is.
Yeah.
There's an adaptation of The Bone Collector, which is a movie that people vaguely remember existed.
I was just going to say, where did that come from?
I don't know who thought it was a thing that we really needed this year, yeah. Now.
Yeah.
And to say nothing of the fact that it's not called The Bone Collector. It's called Lincoln, which is the name of the Denzel Washington character from the movie, or the character from the book, if you prefer to actually be literate.
Yeah.
And it stars Russell Hornsby, who is great, and I always love Russell Hornsby. And so Russell Hornsby as a partially paralyzed detective helping Arielle Kebble, who's playing the Angelina Jolie role, fight crime. Sure, why not? It just doesn't feel like all that timely a adaptation of anything, but whatever. They have a semi-musical dramedy called Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, which probably is the thing I'm most amused or excited by. It stars Jane Levy, who I believe we all love here.
Oh.
So I lead with the things that people want to hear.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
Though I don't hear you necessarily looking forward to this weekend's Netflix arrival, What/If, starring Renee Zellweger, but also Jane Levy.
Yeah, no, anything Jane Levy's in, I'm on. I love her. I just think she's great. And
she is fantastic. Yeah. I'm still not sure I'm going to watch What/If, but I will definitely watch Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. It's about a young woman who has some sort of accident while in an MRI machine. There's a earthquake or something because it's San Francisco, and as a result, she starts hearing people's thoughts in song. And it's a okay enough premise, I guess. It sounds like it would be a Brian Fuller show, except Brian Fuller has nothing to do with it. On the other hand, Paul Feig, from Freaks and Geeks fame, is at least an executive producer, so
okay.
Could be interesting. And it also features, among other people, Peter Gallagher, and Peter Gallagher in the trailer gets to sing, and I am
cool.
Peter Gallagher singing. So, of all of the broadcast network shows, this one and Evil, which I mentioned earlier on CBS, are probably the two I'm closest to looking forward to, I think.
Okay.
So.
I was looking at your piece. They didn't mention Kenan Thompson's show that's going to be on at midseason?
They did not. It was it is a midseason show, and NBC has not yet announced how much exactly that will curtail Kenan Thompson's SNL responsibilities. Certainly in last week's finale, they did not give Kenan Thompson the kind of send-off that you would expect someone who had been there for as long as he has to get, which means that he's clearly going to be back on the show in the fall. I mean, they're not idiots. They know that that is a man who deserves as full a send-off as they could possibly give him if he's going. So I believe the plan is to have him be on SNL next year, just in a somewhat reduced capacity.
Right.
They're going to shoot a sitcom in New York, so...
Oh, they are. They're shooting the sitcom in New York. Oh, that's good.
I believe so.
Okay.
So they're going to work around him because they understand how important he is to the SNL brand, and also for one season, you don't want to lose him just in case the show vanishes in a hurry. But
a la Bobby Moynihan.
So, that was not a good show,
no,
and
it wasn't.
Not necessarily the best use of his departure from
Absolutely.
SNL.
Absolutely,
but
I totally agree.
So they did a really lame thing where, you know, just an SNL skit with Keenan as Steve Harvey, as he has done ever so many times on SNL. Not good at all. It seemed like a perfectly reasonable time to mention,
yeah.
Oh yeah, right, we have a Keenan Thompson sitcom. Also, for some reason they did not. I do not know why not.
And he's a judge on some reality comedy show. He's one of the judges.
I cannot at this exact minute keep track of the 8,000 people who are hosting various different reality and competition shows.
Yeah.
Like, for example, during the live ABC thing, as you will discover when you get around to it, there are ads for the new version of Card Sharks, which is hosted by Joel McHale, the new version of Press Your Luck, which I believe is hosted by Elizabeth Banks. There are a lot of people these days who are enjoying the limited schedule and money that come from hosting a high-profile network team show.
Sure, of course. Wow. Well, he's one of the judges, and I can't remember who the other judges are on this thing. I can't remember the name of it, but there was a piece where somebody wrote a piece about, I can't remember where it was, I think it was the New York Times, wrote a piece about how busy Keenan Thompson is going to be in the future.
Good for him.
Yeah.
He deserves to be busy.
I agree. Now, you mentioned, Fox, now we don't even really know the future of what's going on with Fox.
Well, we know the future we know what they're trying to do, and we know that they're basically putting themselves out there as kind of this pseudo-independent network without a currently aligned studio, because 20th Century Fox TV was purchased as part of the Disney deal.
Right.
So basically you have Fox, but Fox's primary thing that they were attempting to prove at their upfront was, we've got programming that's going to keep the lights on. And so, among other things, they emphasized that they're going to have Thursday Night Football, they're going to have wrestling on Friday, they have college football on Saturday, they're going to have animation domination back, entirely animation on Sunday. So at that point, Fox is pretty much just in business. And then they announced some shows, and I wouldn't say that they sounded all that spectacular. There was a show with Timothy Hutton as a fertility doctor who impregnated a bunch of people, and that's hilarious and wouldn't look very good, except that it's from Jason Kadams of Friday Night Lights and Parenthood. So I will always give him a chance. Fox is going to be an interesting influx thing to watch. They also have a Stephen Dorff modern Western directed by David Ayer that I didn't think looked very good, called Prodigal Son, which sort of positions him as your quintessential cop who does not play by the rules, who somehow becomes the sheriff of Los Angeles. And, oh, what will he do dealing with bureaucracy while not playing by the rules?
Yeah, a cop not playing by the rules from David Ayer? How did that happen?
You know, sometimes he likes to think outside the box. Look, on the other hand, it's a thing he can do, and whichever the one was with Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena, I'm blanking on the name of it too.
I thought that one was really good. End of Watch.
Yes, that one I thought was really good.
I like the one with Kurt Russell. That he did, Scott Speedman and Kurt Russell. He wrote that one.
Yes.
And I can't remember. I can't remember the name of that one either.
I think it had blue in the title.
Yeah, blue.
And I think
Dark Blue. Dark Blue.
That one, didn't he?
Dark Blue. I'm sorry.
I think Ron Shelton directed that one.
He did. Ron Shelton did direct that. Yeah.
It was a very strange and somewhat incompatible. But at this point, mostly what I'm thinking of for David Ayer is Suicide Squad.
It's going to take
a fair amount to get me to think of something else for David Ayer until at this point. I do.
Yeah. All right. Baskets is coming back. I keep seeing commercials for it, and I'm unbelievably excited. So that means we can start talking about that on a biweekly basis in June.
Our weekly conversation about Baskets. I assume that the listeners are pumped for that.
I hope so. I really do. I hope by this point, because we are incessant about our love for Baskets, and I can't wait for it to come back. I'm really excited about it. So
I am right there with you. And the whichever the teaser was that they had for it with the animation,
yeah,
made me very happy.
Me too. So. The train and him hanging on the side of the train and everything was really
yes.
It was great. It was great. All right, Dan, I know you're always keeping busy, and everybody can follow you on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, and read you on The Hollywood Reporter. Dan, always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good. Talk to you soon, Nick.
Take care, buddy. There you go. Dan Feinberg, everybody. Read him at The Hollywood Reporter. And again, follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. All right. We're going to take a break, and we will be back on 720 WGN.
There's one thing, yes, one thing that turns this.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. Let me guess who requested that.
Go ahead.
Ike.
Yep.
Yeah. That would be ABC.
Yes, sir.
Look of Love. I love ABC. They're fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Saw them in their prime in the late 80s, and it was fun. Really, really cool. All right, so that's Triple Play Thursday. Get your request in now. One artist, three songs.
Yeah.
312-981-7200. It's the 85th anniversary today of the Bonnie and Clyde, the deaths of Bonnie and Clyde. And we're going to talk about some facts about them and look back at some of the ways they've been portrayed in TV and movies. We'll obviously, there's one movie in particular that we that we know about that we can talk about. But speaking of movies, before we hit the news here, I want to make sure you guys all come out to see Ghostbusters for its 35th anniversary celebration. My film club, the AMC Rosemont 18, along with Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant, we're going to celebrate this comedy classic. We have a digitally remastered 4K version that you can see on the big screen. Beautiful big premiere theater on the big screen. Beautiful love seats and all kinds of cool stuff. It's only $10 to get in, and parking is free. $10 to get in, parking is free to see this classic Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, Dan Aykroyd comedy on the big screen, a classic. And I'm very excited to be showing it to everybody. I'll introduce it. It starts at 8 o'clock, and then afterwards we'll have a fun movie talk celebrating the 35th anniversary. And beforehand, go down the street to the Crown Plaza Hotel get to the Murray Brothers restaurant, have some food, have some drinks. All the food is 15% off. All your food purchases, 15% off if you are going to see Ghostbusters. So have your ticket stub or your phone. There's proof that you're going to see Ghostbusters, and the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant will give you 15% off all your food. They're also going to have Ghostbusters drink specials, and we're going to celebrate the movie in a very, very cool restaurant that Bill Murray is partially owns and runs. So Bill Murray's Caddyshack restaurant. You can call 847-443-3673. That's 847-443-3673. If you have any questions or if you want to make a reservation, and tell them you're part of the Nick DiGilio Film Club. That's 847-443-3673. And then the movie starts at 8 o'clock at the AMC, Rosemont 18. So make sure you come on out. This is a really rare opportunity to see this on the big screen again, and it's just going to be great. And I love the fact that Murray Brothers Caddyshack is going to join in with us, the tie-in with Bill Murray. Very great restaurant with a lot of really cool Bill Murray stuff, including some Ghostbuster stuff all over the restaurant. So get in, have some food, 15% off. Come on over to the movie. It starts at 8. I'll introduce it. $10. Parking is free. The tickets are going pretty good here, and it's on Tuesday, June 11th. Tuesday, June 11th at the AMC Rosemont 18 and at the Bill Murray, the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant for the celebration. Again, if you want to call the restaurant, make a reservation, or ask questions, it's 847-443-3673. More importantly, though, you got to get your tickets and reserve your seats right now. So go to amctheaters.com right now. Go to the seating chart, pick out the seats you want. They'll be waiting for you on Tuesday, June 11th. Again, amctheaters.com. Get your reservations right now. Reserve your seats right now. You can do it 24 hours a day. And it's amctheaters.com. And reserve your seats now for the June 11th screening of Caddyshack on the big screen, celebrating the 35th anniversary.
Ghostbusters.
I'm sorry, Caddyshack. Of Ghostbusters on the big screen. Caddyshack's older than Ghostbusters.
Yes.
So that makes me feel even older. So we're going to have a blast, and I hope a ton of people come on out to see Ghostbusters on the big screen. AMCtheaters.com. Reserve your seats now. All right, we'll take a break. We got the news coming up, and then we're going to talk about Bonnie and Clyde on the crazy 85th anniversary of their death. So news is coming up right after this.
do or where to keep it. Then I say I love you, foul the situation. Hey girl, I thought we were the right combination. Who broke my heart?
I love this this song.
It's very good.
Shoot that poison arrow through my heart, ABC. And that's part of Triple Play Thursday. You made Triple Play Thursday. That's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200 for your requests. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. A little bit later on, we're going to talk about the best gunfighters and gunslingers in TV and movie history. So think about your favorite gunfighters and gunslingers. And we'll jump into that, both TV and movies. So that's coming up. And but today marks the 85th anniversary of Bonnie and Clyde's death. May 23rd, 1934, they were killed. And we're talking about some facts about the real Bonnie and Clyde that we're going to get to in a minute here. And then we're also going to talk about some of the portrayals of Bonnie and Clyde in movies and TV in the past. And 708 area code says the latest movie about Bonnie and Clyde was The Highwaymen on Netflix. Have you seen it? Yes, I have. And Tom has seen it. And we were both underwhelmed by it. And it's told from the point of view of the two guys who were assigned to hunt down Bonnie and Clyde. So it's not, because obviously the Arthur Penn movie was from the point of view of Bonnie and Clyde. So it was different. The take was different. There was Bonnie and Clyde were portrayed in the movie, but it was told from the other guy's point of view. And I just wasn't, I'm not the biggest Kevin Costner fan. He's fine. But I love Woody Harrelson and I think he's great. But they kind of just both did their thing that they do, you know, without a lot of effort. Would you agree with that, Tom?
Yeah, it was, it was almost like they were just kind of phoning it in.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, they're just like, yeah, Kevin, just kind of be yourself. Just be Kevin.
Exactly.
And
Woody, do your Woody stuff.
Woody, yeah.
You know, and it's fun to watch those guys, you know, work, but it just did seem like it was not, there wasn't a ton of effort that was put into it. And again, man, the Arthur Penn 1967 movie Bonnie and Clyde is such an unqualified, you know, completely a masterpiece and such an iconic and great film that it would cast a shadow over anybody who would attempt to do, you know, a Bonnie and Clyde movie at all. John Lee Hooker, who is the director of The Highwaymen, was quoted as saying that he thought that his film, The Highwaymen, the intent was to correct what he considered, quote unquote, the beyond inaccurate portrayal of the story. So according to John Lee Hooker, it wasn't accurate at all. So that was one of the reasons why he wanted to make The Highwaymen. Maybe his movie is more accurate, but I will tell you this, it's certainly not nearly in the same ballpark as the Arthur Penn 1967 film. We'll talk about some of the other movies and TV appearances that Bonnie and Clyde have made over the years. And it wasn't just the 1967 movie. It's not just The Highwaymen. There are more versions of that story that were told. And we also have some real facts about Bonnie and Clyde on this, the 85th anniversary of their death. Here's Jeffrey on WGN. Hey, Jeffrey.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, now I'm going to tell you what I read. There was a man that came out with a book a year ago, and in one of the chapters, he says, this is the true story of Bonnie and Clyde and their ending. And what he said in the book was that one night they were driving along. Clyde and Bonnie were in the back seat sleeping, and their driver was driving them. He fell asleep. The car crashed, and there was an explosion. Clyde and the driver got out, but Bonnie Parker was severely burned. Her leg was burned up. Her hip was burned. And the severity was said he took her to a hotel. They gave her antibiotics, stuff for the pain. Somehow she miraculously survived. Now, the thing is that she couldn't walk anymore. She could take a few steps, and that was it. Clyde had to carry her practically everywhere. And so at the end, the very end, the last moments of her life, Clyde was shot down outside of the car. She was trapped in the car with guns, and they said she fired a few shots. But the thing is, she was unable to run or walk, And so the guy, I think, that wanted to kill her, he wanted vengeance, Frank Himmer, I think his name was, he ordered the car to be riddled with bullets. So she was trapped in that car, and she had no chance at all. To me, it was murder. Now, had...
Well, you know, hold on, Jeffrey. They killed a lot of people, man.
I know.
I mean, you can't justify what Bonnie and Clyde did. They killed a lot of people.
I'm not justifying it. Okay. I'm not trying to justify it, but they didn't give her a chance to surrender.
Yeah.
They had no intention of taking her alive. And so, therefore, you know, they just shot her down in that car. And had she survived, had they put her in prison, she was so severely disabled, she would have been in a wheelchair for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd mention the story that
yeah,
I read.
Yeah, there's a similar thing in this article that I've got in front of me, a similar thing that talks about the problems with both of them being able to walk. It wasn't just her. Clyde has some issues with that as well. Jeffrey, I appreciate your call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200. Here's Rich on WGN. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I love you, Joe.
Thank you.
I just wanted to tell you a story. My grandpa lost his arm when he was like 14 years old and an auger. And John, this has nothing to do with Bonnie and Clyde, but John Dillinger would come and pick him up and take him to the restaurant to eat and then bring him back home, which was like an unbelievable story. I mean, it's not unbelievable, but it was the truth. And I don't live by Chicago. I've lived in Chicago, though. But I just wanted to let you know that maybe John Dillinger wasn't as bad as he was.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was nice to your grandfather, obviously, but he was as bad as he was. These guys were gangsters, man. They killed a lot of people.
That they did.
Yeah. John, that's a great story. It is an interesting story that there is a connection between, you know, someone in your family and John Dillinger. Yeah. So, but yeah, Bonnie and Clyde, there's a lot of myth. You got to separate myth from reality by looking at these facts about these famous criminals, possibly the most famous and most romanticized criminals in American history. Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow were two young Texans whose early 1930s crime spree forever imprinted them upon the national consciousness. Their names have been synonymous with an image of Depression era chic, a world where women chomped cigars and brandished automatic rifles. And men robbed banks and drove away in squealing automobiles, and life was lived fast because it would be very short. Of course, the myth is rarely close to reality. The myth promotes the idea of a romantic couple in stylish clothes who broke the bonds of convention to become a threat to the status quo, who didn't fear the police and lived a life of glamorous luxury outrunning them. The reality was somewhat different. Sometimes incompetent, often careless, Bonnie and Clyde and the Barrow Gang lived a hard, uneasy life punctuated by narrow escapes, bungled robberies, injury, and murder. They became one of the first outlaw media stars after some photos of them fooling around with guns were found by police, and the myth-making machine began to work in its transformative magic. Soon fame would turn sour and their lives end in a bloody police ambush, but their dramatic and untimely end would only add to their legend. While the longevity of the story of Bonnie and Clyde may be more a testament to the power of myth and media than the couple's actual attributes, there's no question that the story continues to fascinate writers, musicians, visual artists, and filmmakers. So here are some of the facts about Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde became famous, but not for what they had hoped. As a boy born into a family of a poor farmer, Clyde Bud Barrow's great love was music. Bud loved to sing and play an old guitar on the farm. He taught himself how to play saxophone, and it seemed that he might pursue a career in music. Influenced negatively by his older brother, Buck, as well as a shady friend from the family, however, it wasn't long before young Bud's interest turned from playing songs to stealing cars. Little Bonnie Parker also loved music growing up in West Texas, and she also loved the stage. She performed in school pageants and talent shows, singing Broadway hits or country favorites. Bright and pretty, she told friends that they would see her name in lights one day. She was a big movie fan and imagined herself on the silver screen. Fame would come both to Bonnie and Clyde, but not as they had envisioned. Bonnie would appear would eventually appear on the screen that she dreamed of, but only as part of a new newsreel report detailing the exploits of her and Clyde's criminal misadventures. Their fame spread, though often inaccurate, through reports that their criminal activities in the local newspapers and true crime magazines. They seemed at times revealed by the nation, and so more than times enough, it made their life difficult. Bonnie and Clyde never quite surrendered their dreams. Bonnie's movie magazines were usually found left behind in their stolen cars that the police recovered, and Clyde carried his guitar until he had to leave it behind during a police shootout. Clyde loved music until right up until the end. Found in Bonnie and Clyde's ambushed death car was his saxophone. So they wanted to be in the music business. Here is Trucker Rich. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
My in-laws used to live up in Detroit, and up there they got the, I think it's the Greenfield Museum, the Ford Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a letter from Clyde to Henry Ford praising the new Ford V8. He said that was the car he preferred to steal because it was the fastest one on the market.
He actually wrote a letter to Ford?
Yeah. They've got it framed up there. He said that's the preferred car to steal because it could outrun every Chevy and, you know, the Chrysler products at the time.
That's pretty funny. That's pretty. I love that they have that. I love that they have that framed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, you know, that's been talked about on different programs.
Sure.
About it too.
Sure.
You know, but yeah, I saw the letter up there. Well, it's been a few years back.
Yeah, that's pretty
funny.
They
got it framed right next to, I think it's a 32 Ford when they first came out with the flathead V8. So
that's pretty great. That's really great. I love that he wrote a letter. Hey, these are the best cars to steal.
Yeah. They're faster than anything else.
That's right. They can outrun the law. That's why I like that's why I like the Ford.
Yeah. All right. Have a good evening.
All right, buddy. Take care. Trucker Rich, everybody. That's fantastic. That's really we kind of how brazen is it for him to write a letter to Ford and go, "Hey, I like stealing your V8 car."
That's what criminals were like back then. It's pretty. Keep going for a while.
Well, that's the thing. It's like these inaccuracies, you know, about the facts, the way they've been portrayed in movies and in television or in stories. They were still pretty brazen. I mean, absolutely. To write a letter and do all the other stuff that they did. So. Interesting. So we've got more facts. It's the 85th anniversary of Bonnie and Clyde's death. We have more facts to maybe clear up some of the inaccuracies that have been told in books and stories and movies and TV. And then we also have some other than The Highwaymen and other than the classic Arthur Penn movie, there were other movies and TV shows that depicted Bonnie and Clyde. And we're going to talk about that. If you want to jump in, and later we're going to get to gunslingers and gunfighters, the best ones in TV and in movies. And that we'll do that a little bit later. So if you want to join in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. More Bonnie and Clyde after this.
Just to hold her tight. He suits it right, makes it out of sight, and everything's good in the world tonight.
When Smokey sings. All right. ABC. Big band in the 80s, and that's part of Triple Play Thursday. You mean Triple Play Thursday? You know what to do. Get your request in. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. That's also the number to call in or text. We're talking about Bonnie and Clyde, some facts actually about them that maybe people don't know, and then we're going to talk about how they've been portrayed in TV and movies as well. 312-981-7200. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. That's all coming up. We got some texts coming in as we're giving you some facts about Bonnie and Clyde. Here's one of them. 815 area code says, plus the deputy that killed them kept Bonnie and Clyde's personal items and his family auctioned them off, angering the relatives of Bonnie and Clyde. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Not cool. A lot of uncool stuff happening around this entire story. Here's another one. Bonnie and Clyde didn't spend much time robbing banks. Movies and TV have tended to portray Bonnie and Clyde as habitual bank robbers who terrorized financial institutions throughout the Midwest and the South. This is far from the case. In four active years of the Barrow Gang, they robbed less than 15 banks, some of them more than once. Despite the effort, they usually got away with very little. In one case, as little as $80. A few successful bank robberies associated with Bonnie and Clyde were mostly committed by Clyde and criminal associate Raymond Hamilton. Bonnie would sometimes drive the getaway car, but often she wasn't involved at all, staying in the hideout with the rest of the gang as the rest of the gang robbed the bank. Banks were a complicated proposition for Bonnie and Clyde, and when they were on their own, they rarely attempted bank jobs. They more commonly robbed small grocery stores and gas stations where the risk was lower and the getaways were easier. Unfortunately, the take from these kinds of robberies was usually really low, which meant that they had to perform robberies more often just to have enough money to get by. The frequency of these robberies made Bonnie and Clyde easier to track, and they found it more and more difficult to settle anywhere for very long. Here's another fact. Bonnie didn't smoke cigars. Oh,
darn it.
Faye Dunaway with the cigar, man.
You know, sometimes if you can print the truth or print the legend, print the legend.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the brilliant subplots or points of Clint Eastwood's masterpiece Unforgiven, which is about, you know, with Saul Rubinek playing the guy who was writing the stories about the Duke of Death.
Yeah, Saul Rubinek.
Saul Rubinek rules, man.
I love him. He's in True Romance, right?
Yeah.
You broke my heart.
Yeah. Yeah. Saul Rubinek is great. He's a great character actor. He's been in a ton of really great movies and some good TV shows, too. He's a good guy.
Yeah, he goes for it, too.
Yeah,
I appreciate him.
Yeah, he does. The most famous picture of Bonnie Parker shows her holding a pistol, her foot on the bumper of a Ford, and a cigar clamped in her mouth like Edward G. Robinson in Little Caesar. This is part of a collection of comic photographs clearly made for Bonnie and Clyde's own amusement. They were found on undeveloped film that was abandoned in the gang's Missouri hideout when police attacked the house. In one picture, Bonnie points a rifle at Clyde's chest as he half surrenders with a smile on his face. Another picture shows Clyde kissing Bonnie in exaggerated movie star fashion. These photographs, as well as Bonnie's poems, were also found in the hideout, were largely responsible for making Bonnie and Clyde so famous. Newspapers all over the country printed the cigar picture. All evidence shows, however, that Bonnie was a cigarette smoker like Clyde. Camels were their preferred brand. Of course they were. The mythic image of Bonnie as a mean mama puffing away on a stogie is just that, an image. On the other hand, Bonnie liked to drink whiskey, and several eyewitnesses from the time remember seeing her drunk. Clyde shied away from alcohol, feeling that it was important for him to be alert in case they needed to make a fast getaway. So she didn't smoke cigars, but she did drink whiskey.
That's pretty cool.
Oh, my God. Here's Linda on WGN. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi.
Just a little thing, you know, I have a few groups I'm in about Bonnie and Clyde.
All right.
And D Magazine, it's called dmagazine.com. The families are now trying to get them to be buried together.
Oh, is that even at this time, 85 years later?
Yes, yes, they want them to get buried together.
Wow.
And the descendants are actually petitioning to get them. I think one's buried in Dallas, and I forgot where Bonnie's thought of. Yeah, they're petitioning so they can be buried together.
That's interesting because, you know, when they died, Bonnie was married to somebody else. So,
oh, yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, yeah.
You know her poem. I mean, everybody knows the poem.
Right.
Right, and, you know, side by side, they died. But, yeah, the family's trying to get them together.
I didn't know that.
But the descendants of the police officers that were killed during their spree obviously are trying to block it.
Well, of course, yeah. I didn't know that. Okay, thank you, Linda.
Right, you're welcome.
All right, so 85 years later, they're trying to get them to be buried together. It's interesting. And as I mentioned, Bonnie was married, but not to Clyde.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Not generally known is the fact that Bonnie Parker married when she was 16. Her husband's name was Roy Thornton, and he was a handsome classmate of hers at school in Dallas. The decision to marry was not hard for the young girl to make. Her father was dead, her mother worked a hard job at the factory, and Bonnie herself had little prospect of doing much but waiting tables and working as a maid. Marriage seemed like a way out, and the marriage was a disaster. Unbeknownst to Bonnie, Roy was a thief and a cheat. She referred to him later as a roaming husband with a roaming mind. He would disappear for long periods of time. He would return home. He would be drunk and abusive. Bonnie took to sleeping at her mother's. Eventually, one of Roy's schemes backfired, And he ended up with a 5-year sentence to robbery. He was still in prison when he heard his wife's death in the company of Clyde Barrow. Bonnie Parker died with her wedding ring still on her finger. Divorce was not really an option for a known fugitive. So, let's see. 708 area code says, a lot of people compared Bonnie and Clyde to Romeo and Juliet. What do you think? Well,
star-crossed lovers?
Star-crossed lovers?
I guess, yeah.
I guess.
You know, Romeo and Juliet would have been better with guns, but then, of course, they did that.
Yeah. So, guns instead of poison, that would have been the way.
Yeah.
630 area code, the recently canceled TV show Timeless had an episode focusing on Bonnie and Clyde. Did not see that. Wonder if it was any good. I know the TV show Timeless, but I did not see the episode on Bonnie and Clyde. 312-981-7200. And here we talked a little bit earlier. A caller called in to talk about the accident that they had that burned up Bonnie and she could barely walk. Bonnie and Clyde both had trouble walking. Convicted on multiple counts of stealing cars and robbing stores, as well as one jailbreak, Clyde Barrow was sentenced to 14 years in Easton Prison on the Easton Prison Farm, a notoriously harsh hard labor penitentiary in 1930. Clyde only served a year and a half of his sentence, thanks to his mother, whose pleas to the governor of Texas resulted in Clyde's parole. In those 17 months, however, Clyde had been starved, violently abused by guards, and raped repeatedly by another prisoner who he eventually stabbed to death. And had one of Clyde's lifer friends accept the responsibility for it. Unable to take the bloody ham, as it was nicknamed, Clyde decided to hobble himself in order to escape the difficult work detail. Using an axe, he or a fellow inmate chopped off two of the toes of his left foot. Little did he know that his mother's plea would succeed 6 days later. Oh!
Dude!
Oh! That's brutal! Clyde's balance was never the same, and his walk was slightly hobbled from then on. He also had to drive in his socks since he couldn't balance correctly on the pedals of the car while wearing shoes. Well, we got more about this one, too. Man, that's so crazy. All right, we'll take a break. The news is coming up right now, and then more Bonnie and Clyde facts and how they were portrayed in movies and TV. Every single time I hear this song, I think a real genius. Every single time. And people dancing around while popcorn is flying out of William Atherton's house. Real genius. Great movie.
Very good.
Oh, love Tears for Fears. One of my favorite bands. Love them very, very much. And that's Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. Who requested that?
That's Lou in the Quad Cities.
Lou in the Quad Cities enjoying a little Tears for Fears. Cool. It's always a good time to enjoy Tears for Fears. So they just a few weeks ago were on Kimmel because Weezer released that album full of covers that we all know about. Obviously, Africa was the first big one that came out, but they were on Tears for Fears. Both Roland and Kurt were both up there with Weezer, and they performed that song.
That's pretty cool.
It was great. It was really great.
So, and I'm not a huge fan of Weezer at this point.
Yeah, I was never really. Yeah. I never jumped on those
first two albums are great.
Yeah, I never really got it. But I think the covers. I like the covers that I've heard from the cover album.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
And I thought the performance on Kimmel with those guys was great.
Yeah, that's cool that they came together to do that. I appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. And then, I mean, I love Tears for Fears. I think they're great. Even when Kurt left for a while, and it was just Roland by himself. I called them, at that point, I called them Tear for Fear. And he released three records as Tears for Fears on his own, and all three of them are great. They're all really, really great. And then they ended up getting back together for a reunion. They did a reunion. I saw them on it. They did the reunion tour. So I saw Tears for Fears twice, once for Songs from the Big Chair, and then once for one of my Desert Island albums of all time, Seeds of Love, which is one of my favorite albums ever recorded. And I saw him. I had second row for that show at the UIC Pavilion back in February of 1990. Fun fact, I went with Kathy O'Malley's daughter to that show.
Really?
Yeah, I dated her. I dated her for a while. Fun little fact. And we had second row. And it was great. And then you said second.
I wasn't sure what was going to fall.
No. And then I saw him when Roland was just by himself. I saw him like three times for each tour for each album. And then when they reunited, they did a reunion tour, and I saw him then too. I like Tears for Fears a little bit there.
Yeah, amazing group.
Yeah, incredible. And Seeds of Love, man. I swear to you, man. I listened to that record nonstop when it came out, like nonstop. People would get in my car and go, why do you still have this in the cassette player? And I'm like, because it rules the planet. So, all right. We are talking about Bonnie and Clyde. Today marks the 85th anniversary of their deaths, and they were notorious criminals. And a lot of it was... the fame that they had was because of, like, early media stuff, you know. Now we've got social media and we've got the internet. Back then it was newspapers, stories, magazines, and newsreels, and they really portrayed them very, very romantically. And so people followed the story, and so some of it was inaccurate, including a lot of inaccuracies in Arthur Penn's fantastic movie Bonnie and Clyde. And we've got other movies and TV shows that Bonnie and Clyde were portrayed in. We're going to get to those in a minute, but we're still back to talking about some actual facts about Bonnie and Clyde. And before the news, we were talking about how he was in a Clyde was in a really brutal prison, and he wanted to get out of the work details. So he or one of his inmate friends chopped off two toes on his left foot. But he could have been successfully released. He was successfully released 6 days later. So he chopped off his toes kind of for no reason, but he was never able to walk right again. I got to sneeze. Hang on. Hold on. Wait, is it going to happen? No, I hate when that happens. Just sneeze. So anyway, he had to drive the car in his socks because he couldn't balance correctly on the pedals of the car, and he never walked right again. And then Clyde was driving in his socks in the summer of 1933 when Bonnie would suffer an even greater injury. Clyde, known for his reckless fast driving, did not see a detour sign on the road that was under construction. He missed the turn and plunged into a dry riverbed. The shattered car battery spurted acid all over Bonnie's right leg. Bonnie was carried to a nearby farmhouse with only the quick application of baking soda and salve to stop the burning of her skin and tissue. They were on the run, couldn't go to a doctor.
No.
Bonnie's leg would never, ever be the same after the accident because the couple had a lot of experience nursing gunshot wounds. The leg eventually healed, but not properly, since Clyde could not take her to a real doctor. Witnesses described Bonnie as hopping more than walking for the last year of his life, and often Clyde would simply carry her from where they had to get to, which our listener talked about a little bit earlier. Bonnie and Clyde were devoted to their families. Another fact, unlike many of their contemporaries in the criminal world, Bonnie and Clyde were not lone wolves depending only on each other and a small group of like-minded criminals. They both had devoted families who stuck by them through their worst times, and they constantly made every effort to stay in touch with and support their relatives. Bonnie and Clyde made frequent trips back to West Dallas, where their families lived, throughout their criminal career. Sometimes they would return for visits multiple times in 1 month. Clyde's standard method was to drive quickly past the parents' house, throw a Coke bottle with a note out of the car window. His mother or father would recover the bottle, which contained directions to the next meet them outside of town. Although the parents initially didn't like each other, Bonnie's mother blamed Clyde for ruining her daughter's life. They learned to cooperate by speaking in code on the telephone and arranging rendezvous. Bonnie and Clyde had money, and their families benefited from their money when they were struggling, wounded or destitute. Their families helped them with clean clothes or small amounts of money. At the time of his death, Clyde was attempting to purchase land for his mother and father in Louisiana. Eventually, several members of the Barrow family would serve short jail terms for aiding and abetting their famous relatives. Ironically, Bonnie and Clyde's devotion to their family would be their undoing. Barrow gang member Henry Melvin seemed to share a similar devotion to his family. Bonnie and Clyde took this as evidence of Henry's trustworthiness and did all they could to make sure that he saw his own family as often as possible. Henry, however, conspired with his father to betray Bonnie and Clyde by alerting the police of their whereabouts in return of his own pardon. It was on a trip to pick up Henry from his father's house that Bonnie and Clyde were ambushed.
Sneaky.
Yeah.
That's not cool.
Man.
But, you know, Honor among thieves, right?
Let's see. 815 area code says Clyde was also not impotent, which was portrayed in the 67 movie. Hmm. 815 area code said anybody that thought Bonnie and Clyde could be taken alive is nuts. Clyde liked to shoot cops and carried a sawed off bar. They knew how their end would be. Here's another one. Bonnie and Clyde were unwilling killers who released more people than they hurt. On the run constantly, Bonnie and Clyde could never rest easy. There was always a chance that someone would become aware of their presence, notify the police, and create the opportunity for bloodshed. This happened over and over through their short and violent career. Violent because once cornered, Clyde would kill anyone in order to avoid capture and return to prison. 14 lawmen died along the way. If it were possible, however, Clyde would more often abduct someone, sometimes a cop, make a getaway, and then release the person somewhere down the line. In more than one instance, he gave an unarmed kidnapped victim money to get back home. Public turned against Bonnie and Clyde after reports of the murder of two motorcycle cops on Easter Sunday, 1934. Sleeping late in their car near Grapevine, Texas, Bonnie, Clyde, and Henry were taken by surprise by the policeman, who suspected a car of drunks. Clyde's injunction to Henry to kidnap the cops, let's take them, was misinterpreted as encouragement to fire, and Henry blew away the patrolman. The situation beyond saving, Clyde fired on the other cop, it was his first day on the job. Murphy was about to get married, the one that he shot. He was about to get married, and his fiancée wore a wedding gown to the funeral.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. That's a lot.
Oh, man. The public, who often cheered the brazen and brass outlaws, now wanted them caught alive or dead. Bonnie and Clyde were difficult to embalm, and they knew their embalmer. Bonnie and Clyde famously died in a hailstorm of bullets shot at their car by an assembled posse of Texas and Louisiana lawmen. Stopping to help Henry's father fix his apparent broke-down truck on a Louisiana road, Clyde pulled up to the stop when the posse opened fire without warning. Approximately 150 rounds later, Bonnie and Clyde lay dead in the car, which was pockmarked with holes like a piece of gray Swiss cheese. Not taking any chances, the leader of the posse, Frank Hamer, who Kevin Costner portrays in The Highwayman, even approached the car, fired several additional shots into the already dead Bonnie's body, her hand still held a half-eaten sandwich that would be her last meal. The coroner's report detailed 17 holes in Clyde's body, 26 holes in Bonnie's body. Unofficially, there had been many more. C.B. Bailey, the undertaker assigned to preserve the bodies for the funerals, found that the bodies had so many holes in them in so many different places that it was difficult to keep the embalming fluid in them. Ugh.
Sprung a leak.
Oh, God. Assisting Bailey was a man named Dillard Darby, who had been kidnapped by the Barrow Gang a year earlier after his car had been stolen by them, and he tried to retrieve it. At the time, Bonnie was morbidly tickled to discover that the man they'd kidnapped was an undertaker, and she asked Darby to take care of the gang's mortuary needs in the future. Little did Bonnie and Clyde know that they gave Darby $5 and released him, that he would indeed attend to them after their death. And then we all know that Bonnie liked to write poetry. And in April 1932, she wrote 10 poems, grouped them as poetry from life's other side. And since, people are aware of her poetry. So there you go. Some facts about the real Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah.
And now they've been portrayed in more than just the 1967 Arthur Penn movie with Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty. We also have, as we mentioned, the Netflix movie The Highwaymen, where they're not in a lot. You don't actually see their face until the end of the movie.
Right.
And it's told from the point of view who were hunting them down. But the story itself has been told more than just two times on both TV and in movies. So we'll talk a little bit about how they've been portrayed in movies and on TV. And if you want to jump in with any thoughts on this, the Bonnie and Clyde, it's the 85th anniversary of their death. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. They were gunslingers. And so we are going to also talk about the best gunslingers and gunfighters in movie history and TV history. And where do you go on that? It's both modern and Western, that kind of stuff. 312-981-7200. I would wager to say that if we were to make a sort of a modern list, that John Wick would be on there.
Oh, yeah.
No question about it.
Oh, heck yeah.
All right, we're breaking here. Show, show, let it all out. Be Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's wet outside. Be careful. We're keeping an eye on all the weather that's barreling through the area. It seems a little quiet here in the city, but we know elsewhere there's a lot of stuff going on, and we obviously will keep you posted on the watches and the warnings and anything that's happening weather-related. Vic is in the newsroom handling all of that stuff right now. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, and that, of course, was Tears for Fears. Triple Play Thursday, yeah! One artist, three songs. We're talking about Bonnie and Clyde. We just talked about some fascinating facts, real facts, about Bonnie and Clyde that you probably don't know about because, you know, a lot of the portrayals of Bonnie and Clyde have been sort of glamorized and romanticized and stuff, but we were giving you some of the real facts about them. The most well-known portrayal of Bonnie and Clyde, obviously, is the Warren Beatty, Faye Dunaway, Gene Hackman, Michael J. Pollard film, which was directed by Arthur Penn. It's a great movie. It might be inaccurate, but it's a really, a really great film.
And it literally changed movies forever.
It did. Violence in movies, forever.
Spurred all those new Hollywood dudes. You wouldn't have a lot of Coppola stuff coming out. You wouldn't have a lot of Lucas stuff coming out.
Yep, very true. Jay in Kenosha says, "Hey Nick." About Bonnie and Clyde, simply, I recall seeing the 1967 movie Bonnie and Clyde with my dad. I was seven. I like the story of Bonnie and Clyde having romantic allure, fast driving and smoking cigarettes and cigars, and the tavern scene, and they always were getting into trouble. Yeah, that's what the whole movie was about, man.
Seven.
7 years old. I saw it at a very young age, too. Very young age. I might have been like 7 or 8 when I saw Bonnie and Clyde.
Woof.
Yeah.
I can't imagine seeing that final scene as a child. It still turns my stomach a little bit, honestly.
You know, you probably know this. I saw The Exorcist at 8.
That's true.
So
that's true.
My dad took me to see The Exorcist when I was 8. So, yeah. So Bonnie and Clyde, it's kind of like, you know, it's like watching Sesame Street after you've seen The Exorcist. So
great parenting.
Oh, it's my dad, man. Yeah. My dad. He's the best. Yeah. All right, so other entertainment portrayals of Bonnie and Clyde. Did you see the miniseries from a few years ago that was on History and A&E?
Yeah, who was it?
Emile Hirsch.
Emile Hirsch.
Yeah.
I did watch it. I thought it was okay. That was pretty good.
I thought it was good too. Holiday Granger played they played Bonnie and Clyde. William Hurt, Holly Hunter were both in it.
Yeah, they did it particularly.
They were
job.
Well, they're both fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
And Holly Hunter, I just think is, I have been in love with Holly Hunter since Raising Arizona. I've been in love with her. I mean, The Piano is one of my favorite movies ever, and one of my favorite performances by any human is her. Everybody's so good in that. Every single person is great in that movie, in The Piano. Anna Paquin, Harvey Keitel, Sam Neill. God, that's a great movie. And she's reuniting with Jane Campion for her next movie.
Holly Hunter is?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Well, she did Top of the Lake.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, this is good to hear.
Yeah. No, it's great.
Whenever I hear her voice, though, Holly Hunter, I can't help but picture Mrs. Incredible.
Well, that's the thing. You know, what's really funny about it, she's got a very distinctive voice.
Yes.
Nobody really talks like Holly Hunter.
Yeah.
And she's got that thing where she kind of talks out of the side of her mouth. You know, that thing?
Yeah,
and they animated the Miss Incredible that way.
Yeah.
They animated her so she talked like Holly Hunter's mouth was like on her.
Yeah.
Because she does that kind of side talk out of the side of her mouth.
That's not bad. That's pretty good.
Well, you know who does an unbelievable Holly Hunter?
Who?
I mean, like unbelievable? Sarah Paulson.
I could see that.
Sarah Paulson, if you Google a Jimmy Fallon, she was on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, and they did this thing called, he has this thing called Wheel of Impressions. And you know, you press this button on his desk, and you have to do an impression of somebody saying something or doing something. And she did, oh my God, she did three of them. She did Kathleen Turner, and Sarah Paulson was like, you know what, let's play that. Find it.
I'm going to pull up in just a moment here, but yeah. So Kathleen Turner.
She did Kathleen Turner, and when she asked, but she asked Jimmy, Kathleen Turner then or Kathleen Turner now? And then she did Kathleen Turner, she did Holly Hunter, and she did Drew Barrymore. And they all three were unbelievable, and it's a bit that goes on for a little bit because he does some imitations as well. Did you find it?
Yeah, here we go.
How long does it run?
This is so great. I mean, it, this is so superior to that service station on Wilshire. So you got all, this is great, Jimmy. This is so great. I love this. I love this so much. Okay, you got all sorts of snacks, Skittles, Starburst, sunflower seeds if you're trying to watch your sugar. That's it. That's it.
That's her Holly Hunter. Is that not unbelievable?
That's pretty good. If she could have gone lower in the register, I think she would have nailed it.
You know what? I think that sped up online. Because yeah, I saw it on TV, and she was spot on.
Yeah. But that's real good, getting it right out of the side of the mouth.
But the great thing about her Kathleen Turner is that she did Kathleen Turner now. And Kathleen Turner sounds a lot different now than she did back in the Body Heat days. A lot different, and she nailed it. And her Drew Barrymore is fantastic, too. And, of course, Jimmy Fallon is sort of like family-related now because of his marriage to Drew Barrymore. And they're really close friends. So he was losing his mind when she did Drew Barrymore. And her Drew Barrymore is spot on. Sarah Paulson can do anything as far as I'm concerned. I think she's great. But yeah, Bonnie and Clyde, it was a 4-hour miniseries that was on, it was 6 years ago. So it was 2013. And it did cause quite a stir, you know. And I remember watching it. It was repeated a bunch of times. That was when the History Channel started doing miniseries. Because the Hatfields and the McCoys, which was fantastic miniseries,
really good.
With the late, great Bill Paxton and Kevin Costner. Unbelievable. Kevin Reynolds directed the damn thing. That's why.
Kevin Reynolds.
Kevin Reynolds, man. The great Kevin Reynolds. So once that was a huge success, the History Channel started to go, oh, I guess we can do like regular programming and miniseries, not just show World War II footage 24 hours a day.
Yeah, part one of the miniseries delivered 9.8 million total viewers.
Yeah,
simulcast on three networks. That's really good.
Yeah. It was on A&E and History, and I don't remember what the other channel
was. A&E, History, and Lifetime.
It was Lifetime.
Wow.
But it also received, it was nominated for 4 Emmys and primetime Emmys, and it was widely considered really terrific, and I thought it was really good, and it was a 4-hour, 2-night special. That I watched it, I believe, if I remember correctly, I think I watched it on the History Channel of Bonnie and Clyde. And it's out there. It's available. You can stream watch it on Prime Video, and it's on DVD. And I think it's worth a look. The Bonnie and Clyde TV miniseries. Now, there are other movies that were made telling the story of Bonnie and Clyde, other than The Highwaymen and other than the classic 1967 Bonnie and Clyde movie that Arthur Penn directed. And I'll tell you all about those after we take a break for the news, which is coming up after this. Oh, man. God, I love this album, man. It's really, truly one of my favorite albums ever recorded.
That cover art is crazy.
Crazy. And the video for that song is pretty beautiful and pretty crazy. That's Tears for Fears, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday! One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. It's Tears for Fears. It was funny because on that tour that I told you about for Seeds of Love, it was 6 years between albums. So because Big Chair came out at the end of 83 or beginning of 84 or something like that. But it was about 6 years between albums. And so Roland Orzabal, before they played that song, before they played Seeds of Love, Roland Orzabal goes, and is fully acknowledging it, and this just cracks me up. One of the reasons I love Roland Orzabal so much. He goes, yeah, we haven't made an album in 6 years, and then we release this, and it's a total Beatles ripoff. And I was like, all right, good on you, man, for admitting that.
Real recognizes real.
So he's like, yeah, it's a total Beatles. We came up with this. It's a total Beatles ripoff. And Kurt Smith was laughing his ass off on stage. It was very, very funny. Yeah, it's a Beatles ripoff, and it's also a good Beatles ripoff. If you're going to rip off, man, rip off the best. So, I thought maybe we were going to get head over heels.
Yeah.
You know, because I thought he was going to go three from...
You're going all Big Chair?
Going all Big Chair, and then also because, you know, it is one of the most iconic scenes in Donnie Darko.
Yeah, that's true.
That's just one of my favorite moments in the entire movie. Is that whole camera move, mm-hmm, going through the high school and seeing the little girls doing their little cheerleading routine in slow motion. I love that movie too. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hey, get your thinking caps on, because I want to hear about the best gunfighters and gunslingers in TV and movie history. We can do modern, we can do westerns, whatever.
I guarantee you Sammy Davis Jr. is not on the list.
No, but the kid who beat him.
Yeah, Michael.
Michael,
if you're listening.
Our listener who called yesterday with one of my favorite stories that I've ever heard on this show. As a kid, he actually got into a fast draw contest with Sammy Davis Jr. Real story, and he beat Sammy Davis Jr., and therefore his parents got to hang out with him for an evening at the Chez Paris. Incredible story. But anyway, gunfighters and gunslingers in movie and TV history we're getting to, and the reason why is because we've been talking about Bonnie and Clyde, who can fall under the category of gunslingers and gunfighters, obviously. And a lot of people, most people, when they think Bonnie and Clyde in terms of the world of movies or TV, the first thing that pops into their head, and it should, is Arthur Penn's fantastic movie from 1967 featuring Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway and introducing the world to Gene Hackman and Michael J. Pollard as well. But there have been more. For instance, from 1958, there's a movie called The Bonnie Parker Story. And it's the first feature film adaptation of Bonnie and Clyde's story. The Bonnie Parker Story starred Dorothy Provine as Bonnie and Jack Hogan as Clyde, though his character was renamed Guy Darrow in the film. As you can probably guess, this was a very loose adaptation of the true story. It was directed by William Whitney, a guy most famous for co-directing crime drama movie serials of the 30s and 40s. Provine's Bonnie worked as a waitress in Texas. True. The real Parker did work as a waitress for several years, and Guy Darrow was one of her customers. Likely not true. The real Parker and Barrow are thought to have met at the house of a mutual friend. After getting fired from her job, she joins Guy on a series of armed robberies, and the two are chased by a fictional version of Frank Hamer, a Texas Ranger named Tom Steele, played by Douglas Kennedy.
Doug Steele.
Yeah. No, Tom Steele.
Tom Steele.
Yeah, it's even better. It's your first name.
Cool.
That could be your wrestling name. The film was, by the way, I forgot to follow up question with Dan, that Fox is doing wrestling.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I should have followed up on that.
Yeah. We gotta,
look into it. Is it WWE? I mean, or is it another group? Anyway, this film that we're talking about, The Bonnie Parker Story, was largely forgotten, overshadowed by the groundbreaking blockbuster that followed a decade later. In her 1967 review of Bonnie and Clyde, New York film critic Pauline Kael, who is one of the greatest film critics that has ever lived, called the 1958 film cheap in every sense of the word. It's not easy to find. You'll either have to buy the Spanish DVD of it on Amazon or wait for it to air on TCM. But interestingly, celebrated filmmaker Quentin Tarantino is a big fan of it. In 2000, in a New York Times article, he said, "I was blown away. It was like, whoa, who made this? I have to see everything he ever did." So it's got the seal of approval from Quentin Tarantino, this 1958 film, The Bonnie Parker Story.
Well, I better brush up on my Spanish then, I guess.
Yeah, there you go. All right. And then, of course, we have the 1967 version of Bonnie and Clyde. From director Arthur Penn, this fast-paced, gun-slinging gangster film was considered nothing short of revolutionary. Dunaway's Bonnie was sexy, wild, and free, while Beatty as Clyde was boyish, charismatic, and suave, and introduced American audiences to a new kind of glamorized, romanticized violence they had never seen before. Some audience and critics found the blood splattering to be in poor taste, but others were fascinated. Many credit the film as the origin of pulp noir genre, like Sin City, Million Dollar Baby, and, of course, Pulp Fiction. It played favorably in award season with Estelle Parsons taking... Oh, that's right. Estelle Parsons won for Best Supporting Actress. I totally forgot about that. Burnett Guffey taking home Best Cinematography. Beatty and Dunaway were both nominated, but they didn't win. The film undoubtedly glossed over some facts. Texas Ranger Frank Hamer came off particularly poorly in the film. The couple captures him, humiliates him, and then sets him free, which never happened. In fact, Hamer's widow was so upset she sued the production for defamation and was awarded a settlement several years later. There's no denying the film's lasting impact, though. which all but secured the acceptant narrative of Bonnie and Clyde, and indeed the narrative of cinematic gangsters for many, many, many years to come. And I believe you can see Bonnie and Clyde on Netflix.
Let me check.
Yeah, I believe you can see it on Netflix.
Well, it was there for a while. That's how I watched it again recently. I really should own it, but...
Yeah. Yeah, you should own it.
It's just... It's weird to think that one movie can be seen as a turning point for an entire industry.
And you can do that for other films as well that change the course of movies. I mean, Star Wars is another one. Jaws is another one.
But, like, even those you can trace back to Bonnie and Clyde and how bold they were in making that movie.
The thing about Jaws, though, the impact that Jaws made was it changed the way movies were released. Not necessarily made. Jaws was the first ever summer blockbuster. And then after that movie, summer was the time when you would release, you know, your big movies.
And they were the first, that was really the first movie to be released in literally thousands of theaters at the same time.
Right. Well, not thousands. The thousands thousands didn't happen until later on. Like, about 500 theaters was massive in 1970.
Yeah, they were like, how could you do that?
Yeah, and then by the time Star Wars came out, everything had changed. The door was jimmied by Jaws, and Star Wars kicked the door open for that kind of thing. So, how about this? Bonnie and Clyde, The True Story from 1992. It's a made-for-TV movie. From director Gary Hoffman, it never got much attention, so little, in fact, that you can still watch the entire thing on YouTube. So if you're looking to watch it, you just go to YouTube and watch it. It stars Tracy Needham, who you might know as Meg from JAG, as a much sweeter Bonnie, and Dana Ashbrook. Oh, Deputy Briggs from Twin Peaks.
Nice.
Twin Peaks. So this was 1992, so this was like right after Twin Peaks. Yeah, it was right. It was like literally his follow up to Twin Peaks.
Nice.
As a much more sincere Clyde, it's not nearly as gruesome as the 1967 film, given that it was made for TV. It's possibly only a watch for the true Bonnie and Clyde connoisseurs, but if you're craving more content, it is there. and then there's this one. You know what? I'm going to save this. I'm going to save this one because we need to talk about this one a little bit longer than we're going to break here for the weather. But so I got a couple of more Bonnie and Clyde movie and TV things to talk about here. And they were true gunslingers. And we are going to talk about gunslingers and gunfighters, the best in TV and movie history, modern westerns, any of that stuff. Gunslinging characters. Who were the best? So the best at gunfighters and gunslingers in TV and movie history. That's coming up. If you want to jump in with any of this, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. And we'll return, wrap up the Bonnie and Clyde talk and then jump into the best gunslingers and gunfighters in TV and movies. All right, 312-981-7200. So let's get some weather here. Got it. Here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, afternoon highs will approach 80, due to abundant sunshine, but then showers and thunderstorms overnight. For tomorrow, Friday, showers and thunderstorms early and a chance again later in the afternoon and the overnight hours. Some sun in the afternoon will allow temperatures to warm up to near 80 or around 80. For Saturday, highs in the mid-70s to low 80s, scattered thunderstorms will also move into the area. Sunday, high in the lower 70s, cooler by the lake. Thunderstorms possible almost any time. Best chance will be overnight. Monday, Memorial Day. Mostly cloudy skies with a few peaks of sun. Showers or thunderstorms likely. God. Highs in the upper 50s far north along the lakefront. Lower 80s far south. It is currently 69 degrees at O'Hare. It is 70 degrees at Midway and 70 degrees at the lakefront. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back, wrap up the Bonnie and Clyde entertainment, how they've been portrayed in the movies and TV, and then we'll jump into gunfighters/gunslingers, the best of all time. All right, 312-981-7200. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. So it's an 80s themed. It's been an all 80s themed Triple Play Thursday so far this morning. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200 for Triple Play Thursday. And there you go. So listen, who requested now? Is it just going to be Brian Ferry, or are we going to get Roxy Music in there too?
It's going to be both.
Okay.
That's from the 708.
708 area code with Brian Ferry and a little Roxy Music as well. So there you go. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Coming up is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. So there you go. And we're also going to talk about some of the best gunfighters and gunslingers in TV and movie history, modern era, Western era, all that stuff. But we've been talking about Bonnie and Clyde, clearing up some of the facts and inaccuracies that have been portrayed in the movies and the TV shows and stuff. And now we're moving on to not just the 67 movie with Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty, and not just the new movie, The Highwaymen, with Woody Harrelson and Kevin Costner, but there are other ways of seeing, and we've been talking about some of those. And the next one is from 2008, and it's called Bonnie and Clyde versus Dracula.
Wow.
Bonnie and Clyde versus Dracula from 2008. Look, it is really a historical film franchise if no one's made a vampire movie version of it? The answer is no, it's not. Luckily, writer-director Timothy Friend stepped up to the plate with this horror gangster romp. Is it good? No. Is it historically accurate? Obviously not. But it's the kind of hilariously weird horror movie, perfect for your drunk movie nights. Is that what it's for? Absolutely. With Tiffany Shepis. Oh, yes, I know her. Tiffany Shepis as Bonnie and Trent Haga as Clyde. The film tells a new version of the criminal story, one in which, in the middle of their robberies, they meet an escaped, reanimated Dracula risen from the dead by a man named Dr. Loveless. Enjoy. I don't even know what to say.
I mean, you could kind of think of From Dusk Till Dawn as a sort of Bonnie and Clyde vampire movie as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I actually preferred the first half of that movie to the second.
I think most people do.
When they get to the bar, which I can't say the name of on the air.
Right, right.
The only thing that I really loved about that section was Salma Hayek and the snake. That was the best thing about that. And of course, Quentin Tarantino gets to have her foot stuck in his mouth.
Yeah. It's kind of his MO.
Yeah, it is kind of his MO. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I remember being pretty disappointed by that movie. I actually did like the first half more than the second half. I did.
I do like that Tom Savini and Fred Williamson get some pretty good moments.
No, they do. And I think Savini did part of the makeup on that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't know. It got for me, and you know, and what did Cheech? Did Cheech have two parts? He had two parts in that.
Cheech
movie.
Is in three roles.
Right.
He's the border patrol guy. He's the doorman, and then he's one of the gangsters at the end.
Oh, okay. One of the gangsters at the end. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember him mostly as the barker in front of the bar.
Yeah, listing off a few things.
Yeah, which is actually pretty funny.
It's very Cheech.
Yeah, very Cheech. But isn't Cheech in all of Robert Rodriguez's movies?
I think he shows up at least once in everything. He's even in Spy Kids.
I know. He's great in Spy Kids.
Very funny.
Yeah.
And so is Machete. Danny Trejo.
Yeah. Now there's another one, man. Those movies, the Machete movies, are so stupid. Fine, you made a trailer. That was funny. You know, what does that mean? That Edgar Wright has to make Don't into a movie?
Although I would absolutely watch it.
Well, of course I would. I would watch that more than I would watch Machete, but then the Don't is easily the best trailer, easily the best fake trailer of all of them. And, you know, Thanksgiving was pretty funny, too. The Eli Roth Thanksgiving was pretty funny. But Don't is absolutely hilarious. It was absolutely hilarious. I remember when I interviewed Edgar Wright, Nick Frost, and Simon Pegg. I met him, and I got to interview all three of them. And I have a really great picture with the three of them. They were really, really cool. It was right before Grindhouse came out, because they were in town for Hot Fuzz. They were in town to promote Hot Fuzz, and that was the same year as Grindhouse. And so 2007, if I remember correctly. And so I was interviewing them, and you know, they were everybody, you know, because at that time they hadn't screened Grindhouse yet, so I hadn't seen it yet, but I knew he did a trailer for it. And so he was telling me, Edgar Wright was telling me, that everybody keeps asking him about, you know, the Tarantino movie. People are asking about the Tarantino, about Death Proof. But by the way, you know, there's speculation that Kurt Russell plays stuntman Mike's brother in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I know. I'm freaking out. The minute I saw him in the trailer, I'm like, he's isn't it like stunt? It's also stuntman something else. Stuntman, yeah. John or something.
I think he's stuntman Mike's brother.
Yeah.
Because Brad Pitt plays a stuntman in it, and a body double, at least, stunt double. But that little detail, I was like, okay, that's pretty funny.
Because Death Proof holds a very special place in my heart.
I can't believe it was your first Tarantino movie.
Oh, it's amazing.
So, when I was talking to Edgar Wright, he was like, everybody wants to know about the Tarantino movie. And because I asked him, I didn't ask him about Tarantino. I didn't ask him about Rodriguez. I was like, I hear your trailer's really great. Tell me about the trailer. And he's like, wow, thank you for asking about what I contributed to the movie. Because every single person is asking about Rodriguez and mostly Tarantino's stuff. But he didn't tell me. He's like, I don't want to tell you. I don't want to ruin it. I did contribute it, and it's inspired by a series of American and British movies in the 70s. That's all I'm saying. Because there was Don't Go in the Basement, Don't Answer the Phone, Don't Open the Door. Those are all serious. Those were all real titles.
Yeah, yeah.
In the 70s, real Z-grade, low-budget exploitation movies with the word "don't do whatever," you know. Because I think it was Don't Go in the House or Don't Open the Door. Don't Go in the Basement was another one. Don't Go in the Basement. I'm not kidding. And he's right. There were about seven or eight of those ridiculous, zero-budgeted exploitation movies from the 70s. And so that trailer, if you knew those movies, that trailer was just, I mean, I was on the floor laughing.
Don't.
And then just the whole rapid fire, don't. And he actually, you know, it was great because he obviously used, or he was shot digitally, but it was made to look like grainy 70s trailer. And he got the style of 70s trailers down perfectly. So, all right, finally, your last Bonnie and Clyde is Bonnie and Clyde Justified from 2013. So this is a straight-to-video film from director David DeCocteau.
I kind of thought you were going to say Duchovny for a second.
No. Well, the fact that his last name is like DeCocteau is Cocteau alone, if that name is in there, I don't know if that's a joke or not, or what.
Cocteau twins.
Is about as C-movie as you can get, this Bonnie and Clyde Justified. Ashley Hayes plays Bonnie, while Jim Poole plays Clyde. And unlike Dracula versus Bonnie and Clyde, the film aims for serious period drama vibe. With a non-existent budget, it inevitably fails falls very, very short and fails. Curiously enough, Eric Roberts, of course he's in it. Eric Roberts has a brief appearance as Hammer, and Dee Wallace shows up as Bonnie's mom. Wow. So there you go. Enjoy your Bonnie and Clyde Justified. All right, we got a break here. The news is coming up next, and then we're going to jump in afterwards. We're going to jump into the best gunfighters, gunslingers of all time in TV and movies. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on the 18th floor above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here until 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran has your morning drive at 6. And tomorrow, by the way, is Friday, so that means all of our regular features will be happening, including Straight Out of Context, which is when you listen to this radio station 24/7. And whenever anybody at any time on this station says something that you can pull out of context and it sounds dirty and it makes you giggle, jot down the day, the time, who said it, and send it to nickdshow@gmail.com. Same holds true for Nick D Show Spies. That's when you listen to this radio station 24/7. And whenever anybody at any time mentions me or the show in any capacity, we want to know. And jot down the day, the time, who said it, and send it to nickdshow@gmail.com. And we'll have You Big Dummy. That's where we read five news stories, real news stories about real dumb people doing real dumb stuff. And then we vote on who's the biggest dummy. And the first listener who calls in, Tom will vote, I'll vote, and then we'll get a third vote from the listener. And, of course, Fly Jams Friday, where we'll take your requests. DJ Luscious Huscious will play all things funky and R&B to start your weekend on a funky note. So that's all for tomorrow, and we'll tell you more about what's coming up on Friday's show a little bit later on. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And we were talking about Bonnie and Clyde, about how they were portrayed in the media, on television, in the movies, and also some real facts about Bonnie and Clyde. Today marks the 85th anniversary of Bonnie and Clyde's death, so we thought we would talk a little bit about that. They were gunslingers, absolutely. And so we've got here the 25 best gunfighters slash gunslingers in TV and movie history. There's a lot to choose from here, and we've already got a bunch of texts that have come in. And we want to talk about that. It could be modern, could be Westerns, any of that stuff. Anybody who slings a gun, has gunfights, stuff like that. We mentioned, Tom and I mentioned that at this point, John Wick certainly fits into this category.
Hall of Famer.
Yeah, he is, completely. And they've already announced a date for the fourth one, for the fourth John Wick.
I'm glad to see, what was it, the concierge kind of enter the fray with that.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah, no kidding, yeah.
He's blowing dudes away.
Well, you mean Daniels, Cedric Daniels from The Wire.
Yeah.
I always refer to every actor from The Wire by their character's name.
Yeah.
Oh, there's Bunk. Oh, look, there's McNulty.
It's not Lance Reddick.
No, it's Cedric Daniels. That's what his name is. I mean, that's and Michael K. Williams, he'll always be Omar.
Well, yeah.
I mean, Iconic. That's just like, all right. Okay, let's get to the topic here. We're talking about gunfighters, gunslingers in both TV and movie history. We'll get to the texts here in a minute, but we do have some calls. Here's Ike on WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey, Nick. How's it going with you, man?
Good.
Yeah, I have a very perfect modern-day gunslinger. He totally represents the modern-day gunslingers, of course, in a robotic way. RoboCop?
Yeah. That one, there's certainly a lot of gunplay in RoboCop. He definitely does draw his gun. He does give you a countdown before he blows you away. So
yeah, you have 20 seconds to comply.
Yeah, exactly. And now he's doing KFC commercials. So,
well, I heard that they're doing another RoboCop, but it's going to focus on the original movies, because like the other movies didn't happen. So it's going to be like the Terminator. It's going to be called RoboCop Returns. It's going to be directed by the guy who did District 9. What's his name?
Neil Blomkamp.
Yeah.
Yeah, RoboCop Returns, yeah.
Oh, I don't know, man. Well, we'll see. All right, Ike, thanks.
No problem.
Take care. The other RoboCop movies suck.
I found some value in RoboCop 2.
The kid's good. The kid drug dealer is good. Yeah. I hated that movie. And why would you make a RoboCop movie without Peter Weller?
Yeah, I don't know. But I remember once I went to a job interview that was at the owner's house. And in the background, I'm getting interviewed at, like, his kitchen table. And in the background, his dad was there watching RoboCop 2 on TV.
That's just weird.
Yeah, when I was waiting to get interviewed, someone else...
What was the job for?
It was for a promotion at Cheesy's.
Oh, God. Oh, that's pretty funny.
And I'm not kidding. Me and my buddy were both, like, trying to get a shift leader position. And there we were, sitting next to his dad watching RoboCop 2.
Why wouldn't you watch the original if you had the choice?
I think it was just on like TNT or something. All right. And we were like, wow.
Now I'm not a fan of the other. I'm not a fan, especially not of 3. 3 just sucked. No, if I remember correctly, horrible. 3 was PG-13. It was not only Peter Weller, but it was PG-13. And I realized that they made it. I understand that they made like a cartoon out of RoboCop for kids, which is just strange considering that the original RoboCop is one of the most violent movies ever made. But I find it weird that they went kids on it. But the first RoboCop, man, First RoboCop is genius. There's just, I mean, you know, I love that movie. I adore that movie. And I showed RoboCop at my film club a couple of years ago. And so I introduced the movie and we sit down and we're watching. I've seen RoboCop. I can't tell you. With the greatest line in film history, bitches leave, that's the greatest line in film history. I met Kurtwood Smith once, and the first thing I shook his hand and I went, bitches leave, and he just started laughing.
Red? Red man, Foreman?
Absolutely, man. One of the greatest villains in movie history, I'm telling you. All the villains were good in that movie. All the bad guys were great. I'll tell you what, though. I remember the first time I saw RoboCop. That scene where they shoot the hell out of Peter Weller is unbelievably disturbing. To this day.
Yeah,
it's unbelievably hard to watch.
Because it's all practical.
Oh, my God.
You can't CGI that.
And that movie has the most explosions, gunfire. I mean, every 5 seconds, someone's getting blown away. Something's blowing up. And yet, it's like this brilliant, say, I'll buy that for a dollar. I mean, come on. That and Starship Troopers, Verhoeven just went over the line in terms of great, hilarious, ridiculous sci-fi satire.
I'm doing my part.
Yeah, fantastic. But anyway, so I'm screening. We screen it. Eric Childress is sitting behind me because he loves RoboCop. And I do the intro, you know, like I go down in front of the screen. I'll do the intro and say, hey, we're going to watch the movie, blah, 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 blah. And so we had like a 4K restoration print. So we get to the scene where they unveil the new giant robot at the beginning during the business, you know, the conference room scene. And then it malfunctions and starts to blow people away we're watching that scene, and all of a sudden, when we get to like the 89th bullet, Eric and I both go, "Oh my God, it's the X-rated version!" And we got the X-rated version, and I had no idea. Neither did Mike, who he didn't know it was the X-rated version. And so Eric and I were so excited because it's RoboCop with even more violence. And as soon in that opening conference room scene, because it goes on forever, the unrated X-rated version goes on forever. And as soon as it kept, because I know that movie pretty much by heart, and as soon as it cut away to like another angle of the guns going, I was like, oh my God, it's the X-rated version. Eric did the same exact thing. We both like looked at each other
freaked
and go,
out.
It's the X-rated version. We were so excited.
I can picture Verhoeven just, yes, keep rolling.
Oh yeah.
Roll it.
And then afterwards I told everybody, because it was me and Eric, and I think a few other people in the theater recognized that it was the X-rated version, but other people didn't. And so afterwards, I was like, if you were wondering how that movie got an R rating, well, that version that we saw didn't. I just want you to know, you have been treated to the X-rated version of RoboCop. Now you have something to tell your children.
Unbelievable.
Oh, man. We got a couple of texts here, and we're going to go to the weather. And everybody hang on, 312-981-7. We're talking about the best gunfighters, gunslingers, and TV and movie. Terrible movie, but great gunplay, 815 area said. Clive Owen and Shoot 'Em Up. That's not a terrible movie. It's not a terrible movie.
Doesn't he jam a guy's gun with a carrot?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Come on, man. It's a great movie. I love that movie. And it's Monica Bellucci is in that movie. Paul Giamatti. How do you not love Shoot 'Em Up? I love that movie. 708 area code says, I vote for James Coburn in The Magnificent Seven, best shot and scene ever. All right. And they don't have to be in Westerns, as you can tell, because Shoot 'Em Up's not a Western. So we're going to break here for some weather, and then we'll get back to it. We want to hear from you guys. Talk or text 312-981-7200. Greatest gunfighters and gunslingers in TV and movie. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. That's Triple Play Thursday. You mean Triple Play Thursday? A little Roxy music for you there. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We were talking about Bonnie and Clyde, and now we're talking about the best gunfighters / gun slingers in TV and movie history. Let's go. Here's Brian on WGN. Go ahead, Brian.
Hey, good evening, Nick. How are you?
All right.
That's good. I'm going to give you two of them, okay? One of them is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Great, great movie.
Yep.
And the other one is going to be Shane.
Yeah.
How can you not have Shane in that?
Yeah,
you know?
That's true.
Or The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Those are both classics.
Big time. And they're very, very, very exciting, and they're fun. But, I mean, wow. It's got the big wow factor in both of them, you know what I mean?
Got it. All right, Brian, thanks, man. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We've got more texts here. Brian, thanks for the call. Let's see. 815 area code says, maybe not the first gunslinger that comes to mind, but the late Gene Wilder's portrayal of Jim the Waco Kid in Blazing Saddles was unforgettable. Yeah.
Dropped my guns and I walked away.
Yeah. See, look at this. You're as steady as a rock. Well, this is my shooting hand.
Yeah. Fell into a bottle and never crawled out.
No. Are we awake? I don't know. Are we black? Yes. Then we're awake, but we're very confused. It's my favorite Mel Brooks movie.
It's so good.
It's ridiculous that and Young Frankenstein, same year. He made those movies in the same year. I mean, what kind of a year is that for someone? I'm only going to make two of the greatest comedies ever in the same year. Blazing Saddles. Never make that movie now, though. I don't think you could ever make that movie now. But the movie was like that to expose, you know, racism
yeah.
you know, and bigotry.
It did exactly what it needed to do, and it stands as a shining example of satire.
Oh, it's great. And it's really funny because, you know, Richard Pryor was a credited writer on that. He wrote part of Blazing Saddles, and he was supposed to actually have the Cleavon Little role. But Warner Brothers refused because they were like, we can't insure this guy because, you know, I don't know if you know this or not, but Richard Pryor had some issues with substance abuse. I don't know if you know that or not. So they wouldn't insure him. So he does have a writing credit on it. And I've said this on the air before, but people may not know this. You know, you would assume that Richard Pryor wrote a bunch of the racial stuff. He didn't. He didn't write any of that. He wrote all the Mongo stuff. Go back and watch that movie. All the Mongo stuff was him. Mongo just pawn in Game of Life. Richard Pryor wrote that line. Everybody just assumes all the race stuff was Richard Pryor. It wasn't. He loved Mongo. He was like obsessed with the Mongo character. He wrote the scene where he punches the horse out. Richard Pryor wrote that scene. Never mind that crap. Here comes Mongo.
Blow it out your ass.
Blow it out your ass, Howard. It's my favorite line in the entire movie. David Huddleston is so hilarious in that movie. His contempt for Howard Jones, the character Howard Jones, or not Howard Jones. Howard Jones is the guy who, what is love? That's Howard Jones. No one is to blame. That's Howard Jones. I'm talking Howard Johnson. So... all right, here's Clyde on WGN. Hey, Clyde.
Hey, Nick. Always love your show, man.
Thanks, man.
One of the toughest guys I ever loved in the movies, Bruce Willis, Last Man Standing.
It's a great movie. A great movie. And, you know, that's another one that's been remade like 93. That's a movie that's been remade like 93 times under different names.
Right, right.
So, Walter Hill directed that movie.
Yeah.
So, anyway,
thanks, man.
All right, Clyde, take care. Yeah, everybody likes to remake. Everybody enjoys remaking Kurosawa movies.
Yeah.
Under different titles. But I thought Last Man Standing was really good. I also loved, you know, because, you know, I mean, I know a lot of Westerns are popping up here. And they don't have to necessarily be Westerns. But Walter Hill made great Westerns. The Long Riders is a great movie. Last Man Standing is kind of a Western, even though it's a gangster movie. But he also made Wild Bill with Jeff Bridges and Alan Barkin, and it, phenomenal.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. 815 area code says Raylan Givens in Justified was fast and accurate. He gets mentioned, Timothy Oliphant gets mentioned twice here on this list. He gets mentioned for that movie, for that TV show and for Deadwood. He gets mentioned for that too. So two great gunslinger roles for one actor. 219 area code simply says, "I'm your Huckleberry."
I'm your Huckleberry.
Yeah, Val Kilmer, great performance. You know, when I first saw Tombstone, I didn't like it. I'm serious. When I first saw Tombstone, I did not like it. And then it wasn't until it came on cable and I watched it again, I was like, "What the hell is wrong with me?"
Yeah, Kurt Russell just says, "I'll turn your head into a canoe."
First of all, everybody's in it. Like, everybody who's cool is in Tombstone. Like, it's just loaded with badass character actors who are just cool. Yeah, I don't know. Let's see, 773 area code. The bakery guy says, "Gunslingers, Paladin, Josh Randall, Lucas McCain, also Sammy Davis Jr. appeared on The Rifleman masquerading as a gunfighter. He had a quick draw. He read the script and it said, 'You're fast.'" So I guess, he did have a quick draw, but he lost against a 7-year-old kid, according to the great story we heard from our listener, Michael, yesterday. 630 area code says, "The Rifleman. I love Chuck Connors. That was a great show, The Rifleman. I grew up watching the reruns of that. My dad loves that show. My dad loves The Rifleman with Chuck Connors." Here is Keith on WGN. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Nick. How's it going?
All right.
The movie I would talk about for gun battles is Heat with De Niro, Pacino, and Kilmer.
Yeah.
That scene outside the bank.
I can't stand that movie, but that shootout scene is one of the best ever on film.
That is intense.
It's unbelievable. And they based that on an actual incident that took place. Like, Michael Mann talked to people that the cops that were there. Studied exactly how the cops did it and how the criminals responded. And there was footage of it. There was video footage of it that he watched, and he studied it over and over and over again. And it's one of the greatest gun battle fights in movie history.
It is really intense.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. That's a great one. Okay, thank you, Keith.
You bet.
All right, take care. I'm the only person on the planet. I can't stand Heat. I can't stand that movie.
Wait, you don't like Heat?
Oh no, God no. No. Pacino, by the way, is awful in that movie.
Give me what I want.
Yeah. She's got a great ass. And you got your head up it. Ridiculous performance.
Oh my God.
A ridiculous performance.
It's an opus. It's Michael Mann's opus.
It's an opus, all right, because it feels like it's 12 hours long.
Oh man.
The shootout is great. I'll give you the shootout. The shootout in the street, unbelievable. Brilliant.
Was that Tom Sizemore while he was doing a ton of coke and drugs?
I think it was before.
Right before?
I think it was right before.
Because I know they told him he had to clean up for Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, no. I think it was right before. Saving Private Ryan was 98 and Heat was 95.
Yeah.
So I think it was right before he went on that spiral.
That's a rough 3 years for Tom Sizemore.
Yeah. Love Tom Sizemore.
Yeah, and does a good job when he's sober.
I don't know about that. I don't understand. And you know who gives me crap about not liking that movie, like, big time?
Who?
Cochran.
Really?
Oh, my God. He finds it unacceptable that I don't like Heat.
Well, I'm on Team Cochran for this
one. Man.
I love Heat.
Ugh. I was looking at my watch about 25 minutes in. I'm like, oh, there's another 7 hours left of this. You can't watch my TV! And he throws the TV out.
Yeah, man.
Ridiculous performance.
I love it. I adore it. Well, you also hate Gary Oldman in The Professional.
Well, I don't. I'm not against over-the-top performances by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I love over-the-top performances.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're bad, you know, in The Professional, it's more acceptable for Gary Oldman to act like a lunatic because the movie's not based in any kind of reality whatsoever.
Meanwhile, Heat's like this gritty crime
exactly.
drama.
Exactly. And here's Pacino going, "You can't watch my TV!" My God. All right, we got a break. We're talking about gunfighters and gunslingers, and we'll do it again after the news, which is up next. First band I ever saw live in concert, Bad Company. they open for headliners Black Oak, Arkansas. That song is a jam. Bad Company rules.
It's awesome.
Yeah, they rule. Triple Play Thursday, but only, unfortunately, this is only going to be a twofer. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man. Who requested the Bad Company?
That was Sam.
All right, Sam. Good taste. Bad Company by Bad Company from the album Bad Company. Black Sabbath by Black Sabbath from the album Black Sabbath. Talk Talk by Talk Talk from the album Talk Talk. Big Country by Big Country from the album Big Country. There's one more. There's one more, and I can't remember what it is. And I'm blanking on it. But I love that. I love the fact that there are songs named after the band, album, and band, album, and song.
It's kind of like when in a movie they say the title of the movie in a line of dialogue. What are we, some kind of Suicide Squad?
Yeah. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Now it's going to make me nuts because there's another one that does the album, the song, and the man. There's one more there's one that it's blanking on, but I can't think of it. Let's see. 773 area code. We're talking about gunslingers and gunfighters. Dr. Loveless was the main bad guy on Wild Wild West. I'm assuming the TV series with Robert Conrad, not the stupid movie.
But he had a spider in that one.
A big mechanical spider that Kenneth Branagh drove. What a terrible movie that was. Except for Salma Hayek's butt. That's the only thing I remember about that movie. Really, truly, the only thing I remember is Salma Hayek's butt. 312 area code with exclamation points. Travis Bickle! That's disturbing. That, by the way, my favorite Scorsese movie of all time. Taxi Driver. See, there's another one that I saw. I was 11 when I saw Taxi Driver. truly, still to this day, every time I see that movie, I've seen Taxi Driver. I can't even tell you how many times. It still gives me the willies every time I watch it. Every single time I watch it.
Is it Iron Maiden by Iron Maiden from Iron Maiden?
Oh, no. That wasn't the one I was thinking of, but that's true.
Yeah.
Oh, man. There's more. Taxi Driver. There's the scene in Taxi Driver that kills me every time I watch it. When was the last time you watched Taxi Driver, Tom?
Probably about 6 months ago. Because I was on a Scorsese kick.
Everybody should be on a Scorsese kick like every day.
Well, you know, I'm going to stop at Hugo, honestly.
Hugo's a great movie.
I liked it. And then I.
You don't like anything past Hugo?
I'm trying to think what you do past Hugo. I didn't think Silence was that great.
I thought Silence was good.
It was all right, but it felt very self-indulgent.
Well, yeah. I mean, but I
worked
liked
on it.
It
for
I'm
like
trying
a
to think
decade.
About Hugo is a
Hugo was better than I would have
Hugo
ever expected.
Hugo was his best at that point up until that point. Hugo was his best movie since Goodfellas. Hugo was absolutely his best movie since Goodfellas. Cuz I hate Cape Fear. I hate Cape Fear with a passion. It's the worst movie he's ever made. I loved Age of Innocence, but I think Hugo's better. I don't like Casino very much. Casino is like Goodfellas light.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Pesci is ridiculous in that movie. When Joe Pesci's like stabbing guys with pencils, I was like, all right.
Yeah. Departed's fun.
I like Departed.
It's very fun. It's very much like just him going out.
Yeah. I mean, it's a movie he shouldn't have won. You know, there were other movies that he should have won Academy Awards for instead of that one. Cause he got robbed from, you know, by Goodfellas and Raging Bull by actors first time directing. But no, I'm a big Hugo fan. I love Hugo, and I'm looking forward to The Irishman, of course. I do find it weird that he's embracing Netflix, and I know that he's got a solid defense for it.
He's smart.
Yeah, that's I know, but is. I wanted. But Scorsese's movies are meant to be seen on the big screen, and
he's such
a proponent of like saving film and all this other stuff. I find it weird that he's embracing the Netflix.
I just find it weird. He's just trying to get ahead of the curve.
I guess. I don't know. All right, Gunslingers, Yul Brynner in the Magnificent Seven, true, and also as the bad robot dude in Westworld. Yeah. Jude Law in Enemy at the Gates. Oh, that's a good one.
Excellent pick.
217, of course, Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
You can't talk about gunslinging without talking about Dirty Harry. All right, I'm looking at this list now. The Maverick brothers, Brett and Bart, are mentioned from the TV show. And the movie, they forgot to mention the movie, which is awful. It's an awful movie. One of the most ridiculous and moronic cameos of all time is Danny Glover's cameo in that movie, where he's got the mask on over his face, and he's like, hey, and Mel Gibson's like, hey, haven't I seen you someplace before? Get out of here, Richard Donner. Roy Bean, played by Paul Newman in The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean. You ever seen that movie? Have you ever seen it?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
It's very good.
The scene with the bear is hysterical. Yeah. They pick Andrea from The Walking Dead, played by Laurie Holden.
That is kind of like one of her defining parts of that show. I stopped watching after season four.
That's when I stopped. Yeah. I stopped right around season four. I was like, I'm done. And then, I watched the, because there was so much hype and buzz about Negan, the first, when Robert Jeffrey Dean Morgan?
Yeah, Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
He's got the baseball bat with the, he's got barbed wire wrapped around it, right?
Yeah.
You know, and he's not Mick Foley, so I don't think he should have that. But anyway, so I watched the first episode. It's like, oh, who's he? You know, it's him with the season premiere where everybody's on their knees and he's just bashing people in the head.
Yeah.
I watched that. I was like, okay, there's a lot of buzz. I hadn't watched the show in probably three seasons.
Yeah.
And I watched the first episode and I was like, this is awful.
Yeah.
Absolutely awful. Then I haven't watched it since. You ever watch Fear the Walking Dead?
Yeah. I honestly, I got through about two seasons of it and it gets significantly better.
Does it really?
It does. That first season is...
I watched about three episodes and I went, yeah.
It finds its own place.
I'll tell you what, though. The first three seasons of The Walking Dead was great.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
I think they spent a little bit too much time on the farm, but still really good stuff.
But my problem was when they got to the governor stuff. That was when I thought it started to slip a little bit. When they got to the town with the governor and all that stuff. That was when I was like, eh. And then by the end of that season, I was like, I think I'm done.
Yeah.
So, Paladin by Have Gun, Will Travel. Richard Boone here. Seth Bullock, Deadwood. Timothy nice. Oliphant coming back next Friday. Oh, please. Preacher from Pale Rider, Clint Eastwood. God, I love that movie so much. Pale Rider.
Very good.
Oh.
Very good.
Well, as we've discovered when I uncovered some of my lists from the past,
yeah.
I kind of enjoy Clint Eastwood films.
He made it every year.
Pretty much. He's one of my favorite American. I think he's one of the best American filmmakers of all time. And he keeps making, he makes like 15 movies a year. Some of them are bound to stink. And
yeah,
some of them have. But he's made some of the greatest movies. I think White Hunter, Black Heart.
Sure.
Pale Rider, Unforgiven.
Play Misty for me?
Play Misty. He didn't direct that one.
No, he didn't. Was he just in
Don Siegel directed
it. Oh, okay. I thought he directed it.
Oh, wait a minute. No, he did. That was his first movie as a director.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. But Don Siegel's in it. I got all confused.
Isn't there a bit, I can't remember what movie it is, where Clint Eastwood's in it, and in the background on a marquee it says it's playing Play Misty for Me.
I think it's Dirty Harry.
Yeah, it's probably Dirty Harry.
No, it's not, because I think they came out the same year. But yeah, that was the first movie he ever directed, was Play Misty for Me. And Don Siegel's in it as a tip of the hat, because Don Siegel, the two guys that he thanked for Unforgiven, that he dedicated the movie to at the end of Unforgiven, Leone and Don Siegel.
Smart.
Leone and Don Siegel, because those are the guys that taught him, how to direct. Django, played by Franco Nero in the 1966 movie Django.
So good.
You can also throw in Jamie Foxx in Django Unchained. And Christoph Waltz in that movie as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sundance Kid in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Robert Redford. Will Kane, we mentioned already, was mentioned, High Noon, Gary Cooper. Private Jackson, played by Barry Pepper in Saving Private Ryan. I am so thrilled that Barry Pepper is in that alligator movie, because he doesn't work enough. Barry Pepper does not work enough. Barry Pepper is, I think Barry Pepper is one of the best actors working today, and he just doesn't work enough. But he's in that damn alligator movie. the Crawl, it's called, from the director of High Tension. I'm really looking forward to that movie. You've seen the trailer for Crawl, right?
Yeah,
it's gonna be great. Raimi produced it. And all right, we're going to break here for a second. And we're going to wrap everything up here with some more gunslingers that you love and gunfighters that are great. 312-981-7200. Right. Welcome back. Bad Company. That's from their first album,
mm-hmm.
which has hit after hit after tasty hit. Every song on that record rules. Well, I think it's one of the best debut albums of all time. So,
also, I was trying to find out what was that other one you were thinking of where it's song
yeah.
album. Is it Motorhead by Motorhead from Motorhead?
No, it's not that one, but that is true.
Oh, my God.
There's another one out there that's floating around out there, and I can't remember what it was. It was, you know, like Bad Company by the band Bad Company.
Yeah.
From the album Bad Company. There's Talk Talk by Talk Talk from Talk Talk. Yeah.
You'll remember.
I don't think I'll remember by the end of the show.
No. It'll pop up.
It'll pop up.
In
you
two
know what
hours.
I'll be laying in bed at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and I'm like, oh, it's that. And then I'll forget it by the time I get here tomorrow morning. All right. Hey, coming up, Steve Grzanich at 5 o'clock with the opening bell. Also coming up, The Stories That Matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. All right. Getting back to our talk here, if you want to jump in, we're wrapping up our conversation about the best gunslingers / gunfighters of all time from TV and movies. 312-981-7200. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Nick.
Hey,
how
man.
You doing?
Good, good.
Johnny Ringo is played by Gregory Peck in the movie The Gunfighter.
Oh, yeah. Man, I haven't seen that movie in years.
I don't know if you got... I got kind of late, but Charles Bronson and Henry Fonda, Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah, which I think might be Leone's best movie.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, I don't know. I like Once Upon a Time in America.
Well, the director's cut, obviously, of Once Upon a Time
yeah.
in America. Cause
oh,
the,
oh well,
the,
of course.
That's... The four hour version, which is just magnificent. But yeah, one of the reasons I love Once Upon a Time in the West is because the casting of Henry Fonda as one of the baddest
villains.
Oh my God! And it was fantastic. Just the casting was unbelievable to have Henry Fonda play that role.
Right.
Yeah. Amazing stuff. All right, Mike. Thanks, buddy.
All right, Nick.
Have a good one.
Up.
Yeah. How about this, Lash LaRue? The character appeared in 40 films, TV shows, also including The Law of the Lash, Return of the Lash, and The Black Lash. Lash LaRue, from the era of Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. So, he carried around a bullwhip, and he always dressed in black. That was kind of what put him apart from other ones at that time. Then we've got a couple of modern ones here from the Lethal Weapon series. Martin Riggs, Mel Gibson, and Roger Murtaugh played by Danny Glover. And again, that's a series of movies I don't like.
You're missing out, man.
I just don't think Richard Donner. I just don't think Richard Donner can direct action. Although I like Superman. I liked Superman. But yeah. The lady from The Quick and the Dead, Sharon Stone, also Russell Crowe, man, and DiCaprio.
And Hackman, right?
Yeah. Sam Raimi, man. Sam Raimi rules. We got Wyatt Earp from Tombstone, Kurt Russell. You know, you can also put Kevin Costner in there because they came out like right around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Except Kevin Costner movie was 9 hours long and pretentious. And Tombstone was just, like, cool.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't like Tombstone the first time I saw it.
Yeah. And so many great lines. Skin that smoke wagon and see what happens.
Yeah. Kurt Russell rules. And he has such great facial hair in so many movies. He's, like, one of the kings of facial hair. Like, he's got a fantastic mustache in Tombstone. He's got the best beard in film history in The Thing, the R.J. McCready. And his facial hair in Hateful Eight, fantastic.
Yeah. Bone Tomahawk?
Bone Tomahawk. Outstanding. You can also put, for Doc Holliday, you got Val Kilmer. But, you know, I got to say, Dennis Quaid is great in Wyatt Earp, in the Lawrence Kasdan movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's great as Doc Holliday. Here is Glenn on WGN. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, good morning, Nick. Hey. How you doing?
All right.
Quickly Down Under.
Oh, God.
Not a true, you know, gunfighting, but I love the last scene where, the gunfight.
Quigley Down. I've even forgot that that movie existed. It's been,
yeah.
I totally forgot that that movie existed. But
yeah, it's a good movie. Right. And I don't know if you want to throw out there Silverado.
Yeah, there's a lot of good gunfighting in Silverado. That was the breakout role for Kevin Costner.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, yep. He was larger than life in that one.
He was. All right, Glenn. Thanks.
Yeah.
Take care. You know why he got that role. Because Kasdan cut him out of the Big Chill. You get to see his wrist in the Big Chill as they're lowering the cuff on the dead body. You get to see that's Kevin Costner's wrist. That's about the only they cut the whole thing out. They cut his whole part out.
Yeah.
So Kasdan gave him that role in Silverado. And that came out the same year as Fandango, but Fandango didn't get the kind of release that Silverado did, even though Spielberg produced it. Josh Randall from Wanted Dead or Alive, Steve McQueen, please. McQueen. I mean, that's all you got to say. McQueen. I'd even say Tom Horn, and nobody likes that movie. El Mariachi from El Mariachi and Desperado, and Once Upon a Time in the in what the hell's the name of that movie? Once Upon a Time in the West, Mexico. Once Upon a Time in Mexico. That's right. Antonio Banderas. Will Money from Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood, perhaps my favorite Clint Eastwood movie of all time. And I'll tell you something, every time I watch that movie, when he starts drinking that whiskey, and you know he's going to kill everybody, he's going to go to town and kill everybody. I get the chills every time he starts sucking down that whiskey, because that's it, you're all dead. Hackman, everybody, dead. Harmonica, that's Charles Bronson, Once Upon a Time in the West. We mentioned Marshall Dillon from Gunsmoke, James Arness, classic. The Ringo Kid from Stagecoach, John Wayne. And they say the number one gunslinger of all time, again, Clint Eastwood.
I mean,
Man with No Name. Or you can, Blondie. He tells me they go by Blondie.
Or Manco.
Yeah. But that's solid, man. That's very, very solid.
I stand out of that trilogy, that Man with No Name trilogy, I think For a Few Dollars More is my favorite.
No.
Yeah.
It's not Good, Bad, and the Ugly?
No.
Oh.
It's that ending scene with the music chime when they're all standing looking at each other. It's so good.
All right. Oh. Now, I mean, I'm not, it's a great movie. But I think Good, Bad, the Ugly. Come on, man. Legendary. So, all right. Thanks, everybody, for participating, and we'll be back tomorrow. Leslie Felperin from The Hollywood Reporter is going to be joining us. She's at the Cannes Film Festival. She's going to be reporting live from Cannes, and she's seen Tarantino's movie, and she's seen Jim Jarmusch's movie, and she'll give us what's going on at the Cannes Film Festival with a live report. And then Vic's Picks debuts tomorrow, where Vic tells us all about the music that he's been listening to, so to educate himself, and all the regular Friday features. That's all coming up tomorrow. All right, we got a break. The news is up after this.